then. About a minute and a half past the hour. I'm not back in the... Oh, come on, let's face it, I'm a doofus sometimes. I mean, I had it perfect, except for one knob. I didn't... As they might say over at the Guy James Show, I didn't throw the third switch. So I beg your indulgence and your forgiveness. I'm Bob. It's Monday. It's another week of conversation radio, assuming that I can get the equipment to behave as equipment, as well-tempered equipment should. And I think we will. And, I got some stuff on my mind. I'm sure you've got some stuff on your mind. But it's Monday. And by the way, I hope, thanks to everybody who tuned in for the kickoff concert for Still Moving Mountains, The Journey Home, the new benefit disc from Aurora Lights. We had a wonderful Sunday afternoon on the Capitol Plaza on the north side of the West Virginia State Capitol. Considering what happens inside that building, that was probably some of the best time that has been, the best use of space that's been used at that, done at that complex in quite some time. Magnificent musicians. Thanks to the Lone Tones. And thanks to Jen Osha. And thanks to, the Halftime String Band. And thanks to, Andrew McKnight. You know, you've heard Andrew's song, Company Town, on this program a number of occasions. You know that for some reason or another, it just does something to me. And to hear him perform that live yesterday, I swear, I was talking to several people at the time when we heard those first couple of chords. And I kind of looked down, and everybody standing around me was the same as me. We all had goosebumps running down our arms. That song just does something to me. I came up with another one of my harebrained schemes while listening to it. It occurred to me that if you consider the truth of what Andrew McKnight's Company Town says about West Virginia and coal company and coal companies and coal country and Appalachia, there's a credible case to be made for replacing the state song of West Virginia, which is The Beautiful Hills of West Virginia. I think it's aptly titled. Oh, the hills, the beautiful hills, how I love the West Virginia hills, whether over land or sea I roam, still I think of happy home and those West Virginia hills. You can make a case that that should be sort of put aside and replaced with Andrew McKnight's Company Town. And it was a magnificent experience all afternoon long, and I was tickled to death to be able to bring it to a live global audience via the horn. And I will get the recording of it uploaded so that Ben Birch can make an archive of it and put it out there for your later enjoyment. Somebody remind me. I'll try to get that done after the show's over. I gotta admit, I was a little tired when I got home yesterday. And there's nothing quite like sweating the last 6 or 7 miles of the trip home when it's up a winding mountain road, and you just don't know if you've got enough gasoline to make the whole trip. But we did, and as such, we got home. Ferg, Horn intern junior grade Ferg, did a wonderful job in his own right. You know, watching one's children grow up is always a bittersweet experience, because they're so precious when they're little. And you know that you're going to have to face, you know, I mean, the alternative is no alternative. They have to grow up. But they pass these little milestones. And when I watched Ferg yesterday, in all seriousness, sit there behind the mixer and watching the stream as it went out via the computer, wirelessly, wireless internet, it works. I got a brief and fleeting vision of my son becoming a man. Because he was all business. None of that usual running around and going crazy and that sort of the puppy dog hyperness. He knew that this was serious, and he was transfixed by the music, and he, as much or more than I, wanted to make sure that it went out. And he carried the equipment he carried a bunch of it, without complaint, and he took instruction, and we got everything set up and everything going, and I just sort of stepped outside myself and watched him and saw the makings of a man. And that it was something very much special. Of course, you all couldn't see that. We're radio people, you know. Video, not so much. But you got to hear the music, and what wonderful music it was, from beginning to end. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And like I said, I'll make sure that it does go up. I'll get it to Ben, and Ben, the hardest working man in liberal talk, will at some point find a couple of minutes or more that he'll never get back, but he'll make sure that I'm sure that he'll make sure that it goes up available as a podcast. I may have to cut the file in two, though. That's why I said it may take a little bit of work, because it was a solid 4 hours of broadcasting. And if you haven't heard it yet, I think you will enjoy it. The commentary by community residents in and amongst the music was stirring as well. So check it out, and I'll try to get some sort of a post up or something when that's available. Yeah, it was truly wonderful. But no, I've got several different directions I could easily go at the beginning of this program this evening. This afternoon, depending upon where you are, sometime tomorrow morning in other parts of the planet. And I don't even know how they measure time out on planet Gorlop, but, you know, hello Gorlop. Because somehow or another, this is probably going out there, too. May not reach them for a few hundred light years, but won't they be amazed when it does? It's Monday. I'm not going to start this with some sort of a downer. Nope. But there might be a downer somewhere along the way. And it's unfair to call it a downer. It just is what it is. It's another day. It's another day in the corporatist paradise that is Merca. But no, and I got a little something that you might find interesting with regard to the so-called science behind carbon capture and storage. You know, we've known for some time that it was a big stinking fraud, but now there's science behind it to sort of prove it. So we've got that going for us, which is good. But a little cultural silliness might well be in order, just to get things off with a little bit of a chuckle. You know I don't go in for celebrity gossip news, right?
Right.
But you also know that I am raising teenage daughters and a teenage son. So I am, in fact, at least conversant with who Miley Cyrus is. And yes, we will get around, by the way, to the torture issue and Attorney General Eric Holder. There's some good and there's some bad. We'll sort it out. But just a little something to lighten it up, because it's flippin' Monday. And if we start out where I was possibly going to go with an opening story for Monday, we'll all be wallowing and screaming and tearing at our hair and sitting in sackcloth and ashes before the first hour is over. So let's don't do that, all right? Good. No. So I know who Miley Cyrus is. So I'm sitting there. I'm at CNN.com. And I see this headline that just sort of makes me go, don't.
this is news.
And yeah, it is what passes for news. And one of these days, I want to meet the headline writer for CNN.com. And whoever prioritizes the news at CNN.com. Because the lead story this evening at CNN.com is not prosecutor to probe CIA interrogations. No mention of torture there now, is there? No! And never is heard a discouraging word. Yeah. No, the lead story is preliminary finding propofol killed Jackson.
Yeah.
The toxicology report on Michael Jackson topped the possibility of a probe into the massive felonious conduct and humongous actual federal conspiracy that is torture. I gotta meet that guy. So here are the top three headlines. Preliminary finding, propofol killed Jackson.
Jackson, I've only had a couple of drinks so far.
Propofol killed Jackson. Headline number two, prosecutor to probe CIA interrogations. And headline number three, girl dies after Bill washes her out to sea. There is nothing funny in that. But like I said, I want to meet the headline writer for CNN.com. Because I don't know if it would require phrenology, you know, where you read the little bumps on their heads or what, but I want to know how what passes for brains inside that skull actually works. Girl dies after Bill washes her out to sea. No, dummy. Girl dies after storm washes her out to sea. Girl dies after hurricane washes her out to sea. Girl washed out to sea by hurricane, by storm. No. Don't think for a minute that the word Bill wasn't used for a reason. Girl dies after Bill washes her out to sea. Jesus. But anyway, so I was wandering around CNN.com and I saw this headline, Miley Cyrus spotted, and with a single quote, not a full quote, which I don't understand, but just a single quote, Miley Cyrus spotted full on making out. Well, she is a teenager. Teenagers have been known to make out. And this is some insipid, vapid story about a teenager swapping spit with another teenager. Big deal. But wait. That's not why I brought this up. No, hell no. No, I'm bringing this up because we have a substantial and sizable audience of Southern people in this little family we call the Horn. And it's when I read this that I knew that I would wind up sharing this story with you. I'm doing the kicker at the front instead of the back. I knew I would share it with you when I read, because this is all about some young Aussie fellow by the name of, where is it? Liam Hemsworth. I mean, you know, his name's Liam. You know he wasn't born in the United States. We just, that one, Liam went out in the United States with High Button Greaves. But anyway, and the story's about them, you know, making kissy face. But it's this paragraph, talking of Miley Cyrus. But she says she's been teaching Hemsworth a thing or two about Southern eats. Yes, eats. That's another word for food. She says she's been teaching Hemsworth a thing or two about Southern eats. God, I can't wait until he introduces her to Vegemite. That should be fun. But anyway, Southern eats. And then it quotes one of her tweets. Yes, tweets are now journalism. granted, they are a particularly vapid form of journalism, but they are just the same journalism. And the quote is as such, at Mommy Tish and Aunt Di, and at Mommy Tish and Aunt Di, and I, what is that at in front of the name? I don't know. Is that who you, are you tweeting at someone? Is that what that means? I'm behind the curve. And one of these days, the clock on my DVD player will stop blinking midnight. But anyway, at Mommy Fish and at Aunt Di and I are introducing the Aussie to Cracker Barrel Yummy. And that's Yummy, YUMMYYY, space, colon, close parenthesis, smiley face. Remember, that's the sentence that predicated the statement, she's been teaching Hemsworth a thing or two about Southern eats. Bear in mind, this all takes place. You sitting down, David? This all takes place in a city that I adore. The whole story about her tongue wrestling with young Hemsworth came from tonsil wrestling. I'm sorry, Agnes. Tonsil inspecting with young Master Hemsworth takes place inside Nashville International Airport. Never mind. She jumped into his arms and threw her arms around his neck and kissed him and leaned back, and he was dipping her. It was like a scene out of an old movie where the guy's getting on a train and they're saying their goodbyes. Only they done it in the airport in Nashville. So here's Miley Cyrus taking this young Australian actor to get on a plane at Nashville International Airport, and they've been teaching him about Southern food by taking him to the Cracker Barrel. You know, darling, that's why we miss you as a producer. It's those spontaneous eruptions of snorting. Oh, who changed the ringer on the stinking phone? That's really got to end. Cracker Barrel. And I know, brothers and sisters, I know that there are good, upstanding, card-carrying, bona fide Southerners all over the South right now who have full-body cringes going for them. Cracker Barrel is introducing young Master Hemsworth to Southern food? Heresy! Jesus, at least take him to the Waffle House, Miley! Huh? Waffle. I mean, really, scattered, smothered, and covered at the Waffle House. I mean, sure. And it was at a Waffle House in Nashville, Tennessee, where a waitress approached the gone but not forgotten late prophet Bill Hicks, peace be upon him, and said, as Hicks was reading a book, "What you reading for?" Yeah. We Southern people, we understand that we are frequently the butts of jokes, but that's okay. We tell our own about the rest of the world. Like when the Yankee comes down and orders a grit. We know. But when Agnes had to come running into the studio, when I first read this story, because I was howling like a dog choking on a peach pit. Because I read that young Master Hemsworth, in between bouts of tonsil wrestling, had been introduced to Southern cooking by the way of the Cracker Barrel. You know, where they sell phony, ginned-up, old Coca-Cola memorabilia and aren't particularly fond of having, you know, those dark-skinned people work there. Or at least weren't until they had to hang the plaque that says, "We gladly hire anyone after they got their asses sued." Yes, dear?
Sorry, Bob. She's a 16-year-old kid, and they were saying goodbye. But, yeah, the Cracker Barrel thing. Doesn't Mommy Tish cook or...
Apparently not.
Well, if the child thinks that Cracker Barrel is good food, and it's reasonable, I guess, if you're out on the road, but, you know...
It is not Southern cooking.
Well, maybe grits fall into that. You know about
grits. No, they serve grits at the... But it is not Southern cooking. They serve things that Southern people serve, but it is corporate cooking. Cracker Barrel, my butt. Okay, I admit. I admit, Marty. I was making it up about the DVD player blinking midnight. But Cracker Barrel? I mean, when you think about the food, the really legitimately wonderful food that's available in Nashville, Tennessee, or even in Kentucky. Lord God, I guess do they still live up in Kentucky or do they live in Nashville now? If they live in Nashville and took that boy to Cracker Barrel, it's an even bigger offense. So let us bid a fond farewell to Miley Cyrus, but and I guess that qualifies as what, our anti-food porn segment for the evening. So there's that. And Agnes tells me that our news ninja Gene is on the line. So let us go straightway to the phones. Hey,
Hello,
Gene.
Bob.
How are you? I'm horrified. Are you?
Yeah, that was fun. I enjoyed that. But you got to realize, I bet he takes you to the Outback for Australian food.
Talk about adding insult to injury.
Or something like that.
No, I'm sure, and I will warrant that if he's in the chat room, yes, there he is, John Fox, can verify the fact that no self-respecting Aussie would ever set foot in Outback Steakhouse.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm wondering if, and you can probably be sure that she'll think she's being really cool when she gets a Foster's. Beer.
Brewed love it. Brewed lovingly in New Albany, Georgia. I would know this.
Yeah. No, the only real reason I called is like completely non-newsworthy, but just the at Mother Tish and at Addie for Twitter, those are actually usernames that she's sending this to. And if you stick the at in front of the name, it just shows up on their wall or whatever. So that's what that's about.
Okay, well, that makes a little bit more sense, because just trying to read it off of the electronically printed page was trying enough as it is.
I know. I've stopped using Twitter because it's just too hard.
And, you know, poor John's having an apoplectic fit in the chat room. Foster's is tourist beer. No Australian drinks it.
I know that. That's why I run it up.
It's like going to Mexico and ordering Corona.
Well, I gotta go before I pass out. I gotta be able to breathe.
Yeah, be careful. I think you're gonna shoot Pepsi out your nose, Gene.
All right. See you.
Bye now. Oh, News Ninja Gene. But hey, I've got my little Twitter update lesson for the day. So, you know, I've got that going for me, which is good. Oh, let's see what else is cooking here on the phone lines. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Listen, I didn't catch the beginning of the show, man. What did I miss?
Oh, I'm just having a fit because Miley Cyrus took some Aussie boy to Cracker Barrel because she wanted him to eat Southern food. You know, that's all.
Oh, no, not the Cracker Barrel. Come on, that place, ain't it just sort of known for being crap food and racist?
Well, they don't call it Cracker Barrel for nothing,
exactly.
Sandra.
That was like when, you know, in my bad scamming days when we got some money from Denny's. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm there.
Right. Cracker Barrel was next on my list. Anyway.
Yeah, but I'm, yeah.
But Did you read that article I sent you?
Yes, I did.
Of all people.
Where do you...
Larry Flint, you know?
I know. And you know, you just sit there with your mouth hanging open and...
No, I was just sort of, you know, I'm like, what? You know, it's coming from all different corners is all I got to say about it. But, you know, his main point of the general strike is, you know what I mean? I mean, that's sort of standard action for social movements, you know. At least we forget, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and you know, I don't know how to put this. I wish Larry Flint... He's obviously a very, very intelligent man. And I just wish it could come... I wish he could say what he says and come from somewhere else. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no. I mean, I agree with you because... I'm sorry, it's just sort of... Yeah, the source. Yeah, I was scratching my head, too, thinking, you know... We have to be able to produce... I don't know, you know what I mean? Sort of...
Yeah, and what we're talking about here is an article from an article over at Huffington Post in their politics section by Larry Flint called Common Sense 2009, and that's the sad thing. It really is significantly common sense.
Well, you know, it's just pretty basic, and you know, and I just can't even imagine how a general strike would even, you know, be thwarted. I mean, I don't know if that would start, you know, with a few select places.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's just start with the final paragraph. The real war is not between the left and the right. It is between the average American and the ruling class. Duh.
Well, because the reason why it struck me, because, I mean, that's sort of generally where I find myself drifting these days, the sort of left-right thing. I don't know about that anymore, but I do know that a whole bunch of us are being priced out of everything in this society, which has very little to do with my political party.
Yeah, I mean, I still think there's some validity to the paradigm, Sandra.
Yeah.
But what I see is the right, you know, the right is wholly co-opted by corporations, and they are leveraged and they are marched about like little pawns on a great big politico-cultural chessboard. And most of our problems, because the corporations align with the right, you can identify the problem as generally being a right-wing one. Because there's just not a whole bunch of left-wing corporations out there.
No, I understand. But on the other hand, what's passing for the left, though, is real armchair, Rob, outside of you... You know what I'm saying? I think that the left is, you know, really sort of pampered people who can afford this, that, or another. You see, I mean, I don't know. I don't see them reaching out and coalitions.
Oh.
I may even go there.
No. You said something that it would take me 2.5 weeks to actually pull together and say in a single coherent sentence. You're right. I've got problems left and right. The right because they're evil, and the left because they just don't get it. You know, I opened the show Friday evening talking about, you know, Fiji Water, which is owned by diehard so-called liberals who give umpty bajillion dollars to Democratic so-called liberal political campaigns and have people like Lori David and Oprah on speed dial.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, which is, you know,
and they own and they own Fiji Water, which is horrible.
Yeah, I mean, Fiji in itself, even before the dictatorship took hold, one of my good friend of mine vacationed there, and you know, was assaulted, and you know, obviously didn't have too many good things to say about it. And I've never been to Fiji, but I've been to some of those islands out there. Yeah, I mean. It's that article. I read that article after you talked about it, and it's just stunning.
When you get to the part where the guy who actually founded Fiji Water went and founded Fiji Water after he had gotten done founding Barrick Gold Strike in Canada.
Yeah, the mind is concerned.
Yeah.
But what's sick is that those people lack reasonable water sources for their own country. It's just disturbing. And what is this idea about them donating their little charities when they don't pay taxes? I can't reconcile it. You understand what I mean with that?
I do indeed. And no, it doesn't make.
I mean, charities aren't going to compensate for the taxes that these people should be paying for using this country's resources, right?
In my book, at least. You know, and I sort of dovetail that with, lo and behold, I saw another story over at Truthout dating back to last Monday, and the it has to do with the International United Nations meeting, World Water Week 2009, and there's this picture of a little girl in a god-awful hellhole southwest of Cairo. And it says, in Abu Passat, southwest of Cairo, an Egyptian girl fills a container with polluted water. And, you know, she's just not a whole lot bigger than my granddaughter. And you sit there, and that's the power of image, Sandra. I look at this little girl, and I'm thinking, wow, you're going home to get amoebic dysentery. You may not make it, not to your next birthday, but to next week. And meanwhile, we got a multi-billion-dollar water operation on a Fijian island, and God knows how many thousands of water companies selling us plastic bottles of water in the United States, and the water in Appalachia being ruined, and the water being sucked out of the deep aquifers under Arizona and New Mexico and being ruined. And it would be real easy just to curl up in a ball in the corner and just weep, Sandra.
Yeah, and the water situation is you know, just striking insofar as the whole privatization business. I mean, beyond the Lori David or whoever you said is involved with the Fiji, you know, there's a lot of water sources that are being, like in Iraq. Iraq used to have the largest freshwater supply in the Middle East. I say used to because I think it's been severely contaminated.
I was going to say, didn't we ruin that?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's been contaminated, which leads to probably some horrible privatization scheme for what's left of it. And in Israel, do I need to go there? Them people are, like, just taking all the water, you know, out of the West Bank and out of the occupied territories. And denying it, straight up denying it to the Palestinians. I guess that's a part of their occupation strategy. Well, you know, you can barely hear news about that unless you search far and wide. I don't know what to make of the Mother Jones, though, because I'm sure that paper is supported by the various
foundations. Sure. And that goes back to what you were saying generally about the left, Sandra. It's getting awfully damn difficult to tell the good guys from the bad guys, and it don't matter if you've got the program. I mean, I'm just about at a point where I think that if you are a full-on big old corporation, it doesn't matter much which way you lean, because by virtue of your obligations to your shareholders, you're going to do some rotten things.
Well, yeah, and then to hear these, you know, liberals come out with, oh, we have set up charities, you know, that just makes, like, that just sticks in my mind, because it's like, oh, wait a minute, this is another Bono thing with his, oh, I don't pay taxes in my country of Ireland, but please, you know, you need to do more for the darkies in Africa line. It's like, dude, why don't you pay taxes?
Yeah, because I'm sure they haven't completely eliminated hunger, homelessness, domestic violence, alcoholism, you name it. You know, they're on the Emerald Isle. I'm just saying.
It's just that mentality. It's like these people want to pick and choose how they change the world, and I put that in quotes. But the basic obligation to whatever society they're from, the hell with it, because I need to have my money moved over at this Cayman and that Isle of Man and whatever else, you know?
Yeah. and so when a guy like Larry Flint comes out and calls for a general strike, you know, you look at it and you can't just write it off out of hand, because it's not just, you know, it's not just our political system that's screwed. Our political system is screwed because corporatism has screwed it. And it screwed it right out from under us.
And we can get dictates from a pornographer and we're talking about it in the afternoon. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Shit is effed up.
But, you know, when he says, I'm calling for a national strike, one designed to close the country down for a day, the intent? Real campaign finance reform and strong restrictions on lobbying, because nothing will change until we take corporate money out of politics. Wow, it sounds like he needs his own show on the horn, doesn't it? Nothing will improve until our politicians are once again answerable to their constituents, not the rich and powerful. And, you know, this is coming from a guy who is the rich and powerful. Larry Flint's got enough money to burn a soaking wet naked elephant
and take pictures
while it happens.
Yeah, which is why he was funding all that, you know, investigative journalism there for a minute, you know, when he was turning out the various politicians with their, you know, hypocrisy. But it's just sort of, I think that it's so bad that even certain corporate interests are starting to think, oh, my God, you know, I'm not going to make it out of this either. You see what I mean? I think that the cannibalization of capitalism is starting to sort of rear its head because these different interests are starting to see, oh, no, I need to get aligned with something because they're about to take me out too, you know, i.e. small community banks, you know, that sort of stuff. I don't know what it is. I guess it's crony capitalism, corporatism.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, we've got to be careful about calling it capitalism because it is certainly... This system is certainly nothing that Adam Smith would ever recognize.
No, not, oh, God, no. I mean, yeah, he's spinning. He hasn't spun out of his grave by now. Just like I said before, the debt situation would have him spinning. That's not at all what he had envisioned. I don't think he envisioned... Yeah, I know interest wasn't even... he wasn't even keen on that, you know? Except to plow it back into existing enterprises. But, I mean, that's for another discussion.
Yeah, that's why the working phrase for this stuff is anarcho-randianism.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. And I am sort of amazed on the blogosphere, whatever you want to call it. I mean, there seems to be, you know, people are kind of starting to really express some disappointment, you know, in the Obama thing. But how can you really blame one man when you see the bigger picture?
No, yeah, I mean, you've been hard on him. I've been hard on him. But we also have enough perspective to recognize that the guy's been in office for, 7 months.
Right, and that's the thing. That's why, I mean,
But the Senate has been eating poo, corporate poo, mind you, for decades. And so it's, you know, we got to kind of at least try to apportion the blame where the blame properly belongs. I was having a conversation earlier today, and I heard that apparently Harry Reid is in big trouble in Nevada. He's trailing all of his primary opponents and most of the projected general election opponents. And that's a beautiful thing in my book.
Which is why you hear them, you know, lip servicing the you know, public option, I think. I don't believe it for a minute, Bob. I think that if they have their way, they will find some way to scuttle that because I'm beginning to think that the plan is to just force people to buy health insurance.
Well, I have, interesting you would mention that.
Mm.
I have a report right here, if I can find it. With precisely that in mind, insofar as the insurance industry, upon being inquired as to how they feel about the compulsory insurance, their response is that they are laughing their fool heads off. And you kind of, you know, it's not at all hard to believe.
But not only that, but I mean, at least I have been mentioning the possibility of that, you know, for as long as I've been hearing about reform. Just because of how it operates. I mean, they want more market share. How do they get more market share? They get the government to mandate it for them? Man, I'd be laughing too.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's.
You know?
At the same time that they're screaming, no public option, because a public option would mean that the government was. The government has no intent to ever, ever, ever compete with the insurance industry. But that doesn't slow these rat bastards down.
Well, no, but it's just absurd. Like I say, that's what I mean about the cannibalization, because, for example, this report that you I mentioned to you and you have it on your website, the $23,000 a year that premiums will cost, you know, in the next
yeah.
decade.
Oh, here it is. It's
that's real.
Yeah, and for folks who want to see this, this is the lead story right now over at crooksandliars.com. Susie Madrak has a story slugged, Insurance Company's Reaction to Congressional Plan, Hallelujah. That ain't good. And it's a long post for the usual blog post.
Mm.
The half dozen leading overhaul proposals circulating in Congress would require all citizens to have health insurance, which would guarantee insurers tens of millions of new customers, many of whom would get government subsidies to help pay the company's premiums. It's a bonanza, said Robert Leshefsky, a health insurance executive for 20 years who now tracks reform legislation. It's a bonanza. Leshefsky said the industry's reaction to early negotiations boiled down to a single word, Hallelujah.
No, and, you know, the idea of Obama or his White House or whoever doing these sort of back vilifying and then doing back deals with the very people they're vilifying, I find the whole strategy beyond contemptible. I'm sorry. I know politics is about, you know, the compromise, but what it really is about is who gets what, when, and how, and we ain't getting none of it.
Yeah, welcome to, you know, P.T. Barnum is alive and well in the year 2009, this way to the egress.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, and it's, like I said, I feel the need to move away from the cult of personality with the Obama train and just look squarely at, you know, what we're up against, which is the full-time citizens and the media that, you know, propagandize the people. Because no one should be confused. This should be a no-brainer. You can't pay $23,000 a year for premiums, right?
No, well, not me.
Okay, well, most people can't. So you need to come up with a different plan. In our system, competition is what that plan is. There's five big health care companies. They try to say...
But even calling that competition, isn't that just a little bit duplicative, Sandra, to even refer to that sort of situation as competition? Because when there's only five of something, you know that the Sherman Act is going to be taken out behind the barn and beat to death.
Well, that's what I mean, but it's not. It's already a monopoly. I mean, it's like two of those corporations have like 80% of the premium payers, like in the rural parts of America. I mean, it's already, you know, it's like an oligarchy. I don't know what else to call it. But people will go in droves to something that offers them a better deal.
Right, and you know, Howard Dean has, and I gotta give, you know, big props to Howard Dean, because he's not backing down. He said the other day that this whole co-op thing is, you know, it's bull, and it's the way I'd translate it, it's smoke and mirrors. It's not a plan. It's something to ameliorate the right wing, and they don't even like that.
And it's just BS, you know, because a co-op is not going to compete with what we just talked about, the five ginormous insurers, you know?
Well, you know, Richard called in late on Friday, and he's got real-time, real-world, on-the-ground experience with healthcare co-ops, and he's seen, you know, he saw one start with good intentions, and lo and behold, what happened? It got swallowed up by a big health insurance company, which then, by the way, went broke because it wasn't big enough.
Well, listen, can I just, I need to switch the subject because I got to ask you this.
Okay.
What is the deal with the Afghanistan and the sort of endless wars? I mean, this doesn't mesh with this domestic agenda at all. I am like, I don't understand that. I don't understand the liberal progressive. I mean, what happened? What happened to the anti-war movement? I heard that Cindy Sheehan was going to Martha Vineyard. I was like, hey, more power to you.
Go, Cindy.
I know she's being slammed.
Oh, I've seen her get, she's on my Facebook, and I've seen her get absolutely excoriated for daring to suggest that it's okay to keep protesting the war because, you know, we've got a Democrat president, we've got a Democrat Congress, and they all want to make it look bad now.
No, I'm more power to her. I'm like, you know, good for you, because her analysis isn't that outlandish. The wars are still going on, aren't they?
Last I checked, and that's why, as far as I can tell, it appears that, I've got a story here from the folks over at Think Progress that Russ Feingold has asked a direct question of the executive branch. The story referenced here is from ABC News, so, you know, take it for what it is, but it's supposed to be journalism. But what they're reporting, Senator Russ Feingold, D. Wisconsin, called on President Obama to announce a timetable for withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan. And, you know, hooray for Russ Feingold, because this is what he said. This is a strategy that is not likely to succeed. I think it is time we start discussing a flexible timetable so that people around the world can see when we're going to bring our troops out. Showing the people there and here that we have a sense about when it is time to leave is one of the best things we can do.
Well, watch out, because when the progressive Democrats, you know, raised up about the various war funding, the White House said, oh, you'll never hear from us again, if you know what I mean. They directly threatened them with annihilation, electoral annihilation, whereas they treat with kid gloves these sort of warmongering blue dogs.
Well, look, Sandra, one of the first panels we attended at Netroots Nation and broadcast was a panel concerning Afghanistan and Pakistan. And bless his heart, Guy James just sat back there because there was, and you know, this is a liberal meeting, and it was a great meeting. But on this panel, there are some ostensibly liberal people who are sitting there doing apologia for staying there.
The cruise missile liberals.
There you go. Ooh, is that yours? Can I have that?
And I'm not too sure where I it's not my original one. I wish I could tell you where I got it from, but it was just in some reading or something. It just stuck in my mind because I'm like, ooh, snap.
Oh, that one just went in the book.
Yeah, well.
But, you know, meanwhile, Bob Greenwald is up there, you know, from Brave New Films. He's actually been over there filming and stuff. And it was clear, or at least seemed to me, okay, these are my perceptions, this is not necessarily reality, but it was my perception of reality, that he was real uncomfortable with all this talk of all this good that we think we can do by continuing to, you know, fire missiles on wedding parties and shoot people.
No, the sort of liberals are like that woman who's, I think, the UN representative from the U.S. is Susan... I forget her name. Anyway, you know, these are these people who've never seen a humanitarian effort. They didn't want to bomb. You know, they're sort of the equivalent of the neocons, but they're on the liberal.
Oh, you'll be here all week. Try the veal. That's beautiful, too. Never seen a humanitarian effort. They didn't want to bomb. Jesus. I wish what you were saying was not factually correct, Sandra.
Well, I just, you know, I am just trying to, from my own mind, trying to call it and see it like it is, because the money is still pouring into Afghanistan, Iraq, and I have to add this one thing. Obama carried over that head of the Pentagon, Gates.
Yeah.
That you know, that has never happened since Truman began the defense department.
But see, that's more of that attempt to show that he was trying to work with both sides. He didn't want to create a transition in the middle of you know, very delicate, sensitive operation, blah, 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 blah. And he wanted to reach out to the other side, and he wanted to show them that he really, really wanted to work for it, work with them, and it was going to be a bipartisan effort, and we were all going to work on this together. And you know what I got today? Today I got this. You're going to love this. Hang on to your hat. So with all of that bipartisanship, as the foregoing, the right wing is now querying Barack Obama's citizenship based upon the inquiry as to whether or not he is, wait for it, circumcised.
What?
You know, when our conversations are so bang, 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 bang. I know that when there's that two count behind I say something, and now it's Sandra's turn, but I get two counts of silence. I know that the world just went sideways for you. Yeah, really. Dave Nywert, who's done such brilliant, brilliant work over at Crooks and Liars, along the lines of, you know, right wing hate and right wing elimination and eliminationism and so forth. Writes today, the fine real Americans at the Free Republic have found Obama's Achilles heel, his long dark staff of white insecurity. And he's got all these quotes from Free Republic with things like, the only other thing that hit me was that Sinclair said B.O. was not circumcised. When my son was born in a hospital, that was done as a matter of routine without even consulting us. Would the same be true for Hawaii? On the other hand, people born at home or in some other cultures are not circumcised.
Good night. Wow. That is, I don't even know what to say. That's incredible.
I'm having a vision of a courtroom scene. The judge turns to O, sitting in the witness chair to his left, and says, I'm sorry, Mr. President, but I'm going to have to ask you to stand and drop trow. Welcome to 1996, Sandra.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking once again, I mean, because these right wing, they always seem to, at the end of the day, be really concerned about the Johnsons. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and by way of proper accreditation, Dave Nywert picked it up from one of the sharpest knives in the liberal drawer, that being Jesus General over at patriotboy.blogspot.com. And it's breathtaking.
And where are they expecting to go with this?
Well, you know, see, civilized males are circumcised. Only heathen infidel foreigners who've never been to a decent hospital aren't.
So this is just what, more evidence in their mind of being born elsewhere?
Yeah, it's living proof. It's living proof. He's a little Kenyan boy is what he is.
Well, I just go back to what he said, you know, no one was asking to see Reagan's birth certificate, and I just think that is the end of the discussion, you know.
Well, Reagan was a nice, greasy-headed white man from Dixon, Illinois, and we don't need to see his birth certificate. Because we can all tell he's pale enough that he's got to be murking.
But what you're tying this into is the idea that why is Obama still doing this bipartisan shit, right?
Bingo!
And I get back to the Gates thing, too, because that's unprecedented. And we should keep an eye on that, because he said for a year, I remember, because I was so traumatized by him carrying over a defense secretary, because it's never been done. And I'm like, well, if it wasn't done, you know what I mean? They've changed defense people within the presidency, but never carried one over from one party to the next like this.
Right.
And I think that you can carry over to the rest of his. It's like not change, it's continuity.
That's exactly what it is.
And And I just, you know, that just sticks in my mind because I'm looking at the Afghanistan thing, and it's sort of like, well, is the security state out of his hands now? Is that what's going on?
Was it ever?
I mean, that flash Kennedy, you know, this just, it's just also Kennedy-like, this business, on some levels. And we know how that ended. And on that note, I'll say goodnight.
And what a note it is.
Bye.
God, we've been all over the place. Thank you, Sandra.
Okay.
Bye now. And I don't mean to be flip. The core of her argument is so... How do you reconcile an America that's that is absolutely having a right wing that's having hissies, and a left wing that is sort of going, you know, we want to win. This is all because, you know, if you follow the healthcare debate, you know that everybody says, you know, this has to be done according to PAYGO. You know, pay as you go. We're not going to add to the deficit by caring for the health and well being of the American people. No, by God, no. But meanwhile, no talk of freaking PAYGO in Afghanistan. Oh no, sunshine, no. We can run the deficit all the way to the blooming moon. As long as, you know, we're dropping high explosives on brown people. Now, how do you line those up? Because it looks like another one of those Sesame Street moments where, you know, one of these things is not like the others and one of these things does not belong. The only thing is, we can't seem to sort out that little puzzle that's easily solved by a 3-year-old. Meanwhile, in the email bag, the foxhole atheist, whom we heard from the other night, wrote in to note that a capitalist is just an ignorant fascist. He says, I learned in political science that capitalism was born, not created. To be precise, capitalism was born in England within 20 years of the birth of capitalism. The Irish potato famine happened. Capitalism is what we get when the people abdicate our responsibility to improve society and protect human rights. You guys are off and running. Especially in light of it being a Monday and everything. So much for my idea starting funny. Hey, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. You're in Arizona.
Hey, what's up, Fancy?
Hey, sweet. Yeah, well, I had this geekly little story about Southern food, and then you and Sandra got off, and I'm going, what?
No. Hey, wait, Shane, come back, Shane. No,
yes,
no.
Yes, it just took off with me. But I had a thought about the circumcision thing. Now, the Muslim is a within the Semite world there. And at Jews circumcised centuries ago without hospitals, is that also, somebody in the chat room is going to know, is circumcision also a part of Muslim practice?
My initial response is to say no, because if I recall correctly, there were issues surrounding that during the Crusades whereby, you know, having been involuntarily genetically mutilated at birth was a dead giveaway for who you weren't. And in a society where everybody's the same color, and whether you call yourself Muslim or Jewish, you've got, you know, dark hair, dark complexion, same. You know,
gene pool back there somewhere.
Right. And, you know, just for historical accuracy, because I'm geeky this way, let's do understand that neither side invented it. It was, as far as we know, it was first practiced among the ancient Egyptians, who did it at 13. And upon, that's the thing. Upon leaving said Egypt, said children of Israel looked up and said, nifty idea that, but let's not wait till they're 13. And the next thing you know, lo and behold, God's saying, do it right after they're born. Good idea, God.
I won't give you my childhood attitude about whatever that God might be, but I do have a Southern story. So, and now, you know, my family came from Chicago and Wisconsin, and so I'm the only real Texan, aside from a sister there who came along, but... And so my cooking, my palate was formed, strangely enough, in elementary school, school cafeteria. Ew.
Yeah.
And oh, there are certain things I totally love that are very seriously Southern. So I brought my kids out here to Arizona when they were quite small. And when you live in Arizona, Arizona is like the most generic American whatever. You know, you ever heard anybody say, oh, they got an Arizona accent?
Really?
There is no.
No
Arizona accent.
There's no such animal, is there?
We are incredibly, well, down in Tucson, where I am, it's just wonderful because it's really a live and let live place. And although we have a perchance for Sonoran cooking, which is second nature around here. Anyway, back to, there was a little, they opened a restaurant with Southern cuisine. So my kids, I think, were in high school then, and we went off to this restaurant to have a Southern meal, and I ordered one of my favorites, which is greens. And I don't know how you eat your greens, but where I come from, you eat your greens with vinegar, with brown vinegar.
That's the way my mother loved them. I took it to the next step, and I throw a blast of hot sauce on them. But that's me.
Okay, well, I'm the brown vinegar type with my greens, and I put a few drops of vinegar on my greens, and I go and my kids kind of look at me, and I said, "Do you want to taste this?" And I pushed it over, and Wendy took a bite, and she thought for a minute, and then she asked me that wonderful question: "You eat this voluntarily?" And I said, "Well, it's an acquired taste." And I realized that if you...
Lord, I must have acquired it at an early age, because I don't remember a time when I didn't love greens.
Yeah, yeah. And I just think, you know, I don't need it every day, but every now and then some greens with some vinegar.
I can't tell you the number of times I've looked at Agnes and said, you know, honey, if we could have greens, if there could be a pot of greens every day of the week, I'd have me some. And somehow it doesn't...
There's no way that we can ever convince an adult who doesn't have this that this is good food.
I don't know what's wrong with them.
And they will say, quite interesting.
Of course, it all depends on the greens. I'm partial to turnip greens, but a lot of people are partial to collards.
Yeah, I'm talking collard here.
But hereabouts we do kale, we do mustard greens. Love mustard greens because you get that little bite, that little mustardy thing going on even in the leaves, and woo, good.
Well, I do think it's kind of, you know, I lived in Europe for a while, and one of the things that happens when you're an expat is that you have this thing about comfort food from home. And mine was like Rice Krispies. If somebody would send me cereal from home, that was a big deal. Various things. I had an Australian girlfriend, and her mom would send her Vegemite, and she'd just stand there and open that thing, and there is scent is much too delicate a word for what happens when you open a bottle of Vegemite.
So I've been told.
And I go, and she go, because that's what her childhood had in it.
Yeah, that's the taste of home.
Yeah, and somehow there's something about what happens in your, you know,
Let's put it this way: taste buds are trained too. How's that?
I dated a man for a while who was an exchange academic at the university here, and he was from a place called Cape Verde, Cabo Verde. And he had a phrase that I really, really loved. They're Portuguese speakers, and sometimes it would be one for one. You know, he'd say in Portuguese and then translate into English, the black sheep of the family. And you'd go, oh, that's one for one. We have that too. Otherwise, there were certain sayings, and one of his sayings that I loved about philosophy, and he would say, that came with the home tea. Isn't that a lovely thought?
Yes.
That whatever the tea was that was served at your home table is part of this philosophy. And I use it now and then just to remind myself that you know, so much of what's right and true to us is it came with the home tea. It came in the teacup. Now Larry Flint.
Oh, well, just quick. We've been corrected.
What? Tell me.
The horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner wrote in to remind me that, yes, Muslims do practice circumcision. And so he says, you know, sorry, right-wingers, that means he's not a Muslim. But that's okay. They'll give up.
We haven't ascertained if he's trimmed or not.
Well, they're asserting that he's not. So, but that you know, that gives the Muslims, or I mean the Muslims, that gives the right wingers, they got to pick. They can have him Muslim, but they'll be happy if he's just African and not really Merkin, because that's what they got to hang their hats on. Because, you know, he wasn't because what they're looking for at the bottom of all of this fancy, what they're looking for is some reason to claim that Barack Obama is not legitimately the president, because they know damn good and well that George W. Bush never was. Only for obvious reasons of having dummied up an election.
I think that's far too sophisticated for your.
Am I too nuanced to be a right winger?
I just think that we got folks who are going on. I mean, you know, you got to remember these are the people who believe that the serpent talked to their ancestor, and they're pretty good at believing what they feel is right.
Damn chatty copperhead.
And yeah, keep thinking about that. I want to say on Larry Flint though that Larry Flint has always been a strong proponent of First Amendment.
Sure.
And what was the name of the movie? Somebody in the chat room will know that Woody Harrelson played the part.
The People versus Larry Flint?
Yeah. And that he always has been. Who's the Playboy guy?
Hugh Hefner.
They've always been strong First Amendment people. Now, we can question their taste. You know, and things could have been done in a more tasteful manner sometimes. But yay for Larry Flint, yay for the folks that have, and yay for the out-and-out pornographers.
Sure, and that's not really where I was going when I said that, when I said what I said. It's just that because he is Larry Flint, qua Larry Flint, the entire right wing will write him off. Well, he's a smut merchant. And a big chunk of our side fancy. You mean our side will say, well, you know, I mean, we can't take him seriously.
And I think what Larry's missing here, and Hartman brings it up sometimes, is yes, it would be really nice to have people in the streets. But we've got people who work two and three jobs trying to feed families. That we've got two sorts of people going on here. One who are just working their butts off, and the other who, well, if it's uncomfortable, I'd rather not do it, folks. And I think there's way too much of both of that in our political world. You know, we got to realize that most people don't have the passion of the Horn family. But our dear and beloved Hornies have a passion that's not common in the world.
Oh, you're going to make me get all Henry V, aren't you? We few.
We
happy few.
Once more under the breach, dear friend.
And, you know, that's kind of where we live, isn't it?
Or close up the wall with our English dead, and upon this charge, cry.
England and...
Harry.
Harry and St.
Harry
George.
Harry, England, and...
Harry, England, and St. George.
Hooray! You got it.
Yeah, I was about lost there, because there's a moment where he starts talking about St. Davy's Day, too, so... But the real Henry V was a religious fanatic, so he knew all his saints.
Those who were with us on St. Crispin's Day.
Yeah, who the hell was St. Crispin?
Oh, well, he's very British.
Does he have anything to do with the cereal that they mailed you while you were in Europe?
It's too wonderful.
Was his first name Snap, Crackle, or Pop? I don't know. I could never keep up with saints.
Which gave me another thought on capitalism while you were talking today, and I was thinking... Religion, capital R religion, capital C Christianity, and you ask 20 people from different denominations what is Christianity, and you're not going to get a consensus here. You know, you get the Baptists and the Methodists and the Presbyterians and the Mormons and the Apostolic Pentecostals and all these good people together, and you say, what is Christianity? And we're not going to have consensus. But they know that what they believe is sacred. It's capital S sacred. And I think with the capitalist, you're going to have a lot of the same thing going here, that somehow it's been made into a sanctified thought that capital is sacred. You know, their old joke about somebody, you know, did they sin? No, they dipped into their principle. There's just some, which is really way back. But I think that we have this going, that there is a almost a deification into capitalism, which has nothing to do with good with rational thinking, as most religion doesn't either. But you start messing with it, and you're going to make some adherents pretty angry.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
You piss those dudes off. I can go on for hours. I grew up in a, you know, family business, a small retail store. It fed us. It put us through college. It did well by us. You couldn't have that today. No way.
No. No, no. You can't compete with corporate America. You can't compete on the buying scale. You know, I've got a very good friend who runs a small but successful business in a small West Virginia town, and he was scared to death that he was going to get run out of business when Walmart came to that small town. But he has actually grown and prospered because the one thing he can do that Walmart can't is provide a level of service that Walmart can only dream of. And apparently, among people who are trying to stay alive when the big box store arrives, if you can't provide superior service, you will never compete with them on price or availability.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, but again, it's really touch and go. I remember my parents were just very frightened of when malls started, you know, the concept of malls a short drive from our town. And yet my family store, I think, probably could have stayed in business because one of the things they specialized in were hard-to-fit shoes, you know. So I remember we had customers who wore, my husband wore a 9 on one foot and a 7 on the other, and we won't even go into that one. Or people who wore combination lasts, that they had narrow heels and broad toes or whatever.
Well, that's the story of the Kincaid foot right there. We've got heels like razor blades. And feet like frog. The front of our feet are like frogs.
My advice to you is find a shoe maker, a shoe repair person, who's old enough to know, who has that craftsman, the old world craftsman ethnos, who understands what they're doing. And once you find them, you hold on to them as dearly as you do a really good car mechanic.
Yeah. Because people have heard me complaining after a day of, or after, you know, several days of hardcore walking, you know, and Guy's right. I mean, I love to walk, and I can go, I do real good, but my shoes just destroy me, and they have since the time I was tiny. I had to have specially fit shoes because I was born without arches. I mean, not just flat footed, but
flat footed children.
No, I was almost concave, and so yeah, I wore some very ugly shoes as a child.
If you've got somebody who can produce your orthotics, you're okay. Otherwise, you're in big.
Yeah, well, to this day, I still reach into the shoe, and has it got an arch? Has it got an arch? Because my life gets better when there's a built-up arch in a shoe. But I was gonna mention one other thing, Fancy, because you know, you do appreciate the language, and you obviously know the meaning of the shoe-related vocabulary. I grew up with a saying in my home, and both my father and my mother used it. And I don't know, how can I put this in context? My dad would say, Margaret, would you bring me a bowl of ice cream? And my mother would respond, can't do it. The boy got what the shoemaker hit his wife with.
The last.
The last.
That. Yeah, you came from a very, very erudite family.
No, they just knew what went into a shoe because they had to make them last for extended periods of time, having been A, poor kids, and B, Depression-era poor kids.
The last. Okay, well, I have a joke for you now on that, too. After when you and again, when you got into the bottled water thing, you remember I was telling you somebody once referred to the, is the bottled water is the pet rock that lived?
Yes.
And I always think of that. But now you've got a couple, and they've gone to the doctor, and the doctor says, well, you know, you guys are having some memory problems there. And he says, there's not much I can do about it. I just suggest you write things down, and that'll help you. So they're home in the evening, and he gets up, and he says, I'm going to go to the kitchen. You want anything? And she says, well, yeah, I do. I want a bowl of ice cream. And you want to write that down? He said, no, I can remember a bowl of ice cream. And she said, you know what, I really would like some bananas on that. And he said, you want to write that down? And he said, no, I can chop up a banana, a bowl of ice cream banana. She says, you know, and you put some chocolate syrup on it, that'd be really good. You want to write that down? He said, well, no, bowl of ice cream and bananas and some chocolate syrup. And so he came back about half an hour later, and he hands her a dish, and soft fried eggs, and some potatoes, little chopped up potatoes. They're fried, and she said, "See, I told you to write that down. You forgot the toast." So bad.
Yeah, that's right up there with the joke in Annie Hall that Woody Allen tells about the man who thought he was a chicken, and they took him to a therapist.
No, we need the eggs.
Yeah, but somebody tell him he's not a chicken. Well, we would, but we need the eggs.
So what's the one about being a refrigerator, and now we need the light, when the light to come on? Yeah. There's a whole panoply of those. Oh, I've spoken way longer than I care to. Hun, thanks so much, and let's get into the Dorger stuff.
We're gonna. We will find our way there sooner rather than later. Fancy, take care.
Okay, hugs to all. Bye-bye.
Always a joy hearing from you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. And we will keep it rolling, yes, because I think there's some nuance in it. Because you do realize that Eric Holder, if I understand correctly, didn't say he was going to start an inquiry into torture. He said he was going to have someone investigate whether or not they ought to investigate and prosecute torture. So we're still, we're still a couple of degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon where that's all concerned. I mean, just saying. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Brother Bob, how are we today?
Brother Albert, we're going to get by.
Yeah, we are, aren't we? Yeah, I'm here with you on St. Crispin's Day. We got that. You know, I'll tell you what, Fancy hit a bunch out of the park on that one. I caught the program, halfway through your reading on capitalism. And, it's one of those things that just, I don't understand why they don't want to upgrade it. You know what I mean? Like, why can't they just look at it and say, you know what, it's got some good things about it, and it's got some things that can improve. I don't understand how, it is a religious thing. That's the only thing that makes any sense, is it has to be some sort of religious.
Well, right, because if it weren't for dogma, the communion wafer would come in flavors now. But you can't, because it's dogmatic and doctrinal, and as such, no, you can't be monkeying with the capitalism. Because time after time we found out that, don't work so good. Never really has. But now that it's a religion, it's enshrined. And so no touchy-touchy. No, I think you're absolutely correct.
Yeah, no. It's just maddening. I mean, there's so many. It's once again, it's people can't read the road signs. They just ignore them. It's, the end of highway, stupid. There's only so far that anything's going to get you. Even Mercedes-Benz diesel engines die after a little while,
Yeah, half a million miles or so. But that's for the first rebuild, but never, I get your point.
This is just unbelievable. And you know, and then yeah, of course, and you, I think personally, I think you hit it dead on with the right's just insistence on this whole. Now they're talking about the president's penis again. They just love presidential, Democratic presidential penis.
Look, the Republican Party is a great, big, sad, terrifying closet. I mean, how many times do we have to establish this?
the dam is dry at the top now. We can keep piling it up, you know, for that really, we can prepare for the Katrina. These guys are, they just keep establishing their lunacy every day, don't they? It's just unbelievable.
Oh, I've got the story in the stack about the Arizona preacher. Have you run across this one?
No, I don't think I hit that one yet.
It comes from let me get to the right tab. It comes to us via the extraordinary work that continuously is done by Pam Spalding over at Pam's House Blend. And she just found this upstanding man of God. You know, anytime I start something with that, it's not going to work out well. And if you've ever seen a photo of a guy of a closet case, this guy is the poster child for closet case, and he's openly calling for the execution of, among other things, gay people and Barney Frank. Gay people generally, Barney Frank specifically. Oh, and by the way, he also wants Barack. He also wants President Not Sure executed too.
Uh-huh.
Let me just pop this into the chat room real quick.
Yikes!
Yeah, I mean, we'll just do a very very cheap non-scientific survey of the chat room and see if this guy just really isn't the poster child for closet case, because I really think he is. He says, the same God who instituted the death penalty for murderers is the same God who instituted the death penalty for rapists and for homosexuals and sodomites and queers. And then goes on and says, the sodomites are recruiters, and you know who they're after? Your children. They're being recruited by the sodomites. They are being molested by the sodomites. They recruit through rape. They recruit through molestation. They recruit through violation. Our country is run by faggots. You know who was the man who was the architect of the bailout? His name is Barney Frank. He is a pedophile. That's who just sold our country into fascism. That's who just sold our corporations to the government. That's who sold out our country. A faggot. But that wasn't enough. No, this is a Ginsu commercial. There's more.
There's more, of course.
God hates, and this is not some Phelps guy, okay? This guy's,
yeah,
this guy's an independent actor. You know, he doesn't have Shirley Phelps or the really hideous neon signs. No. God hates Barack Obama. I hate Barack Obama. I hate him. God wants me to hate Barack Obama. And then he goes on a little bit later and he says, someone who commits murder should get the death penalty.
Okay.
Yeah, I know.
Wow. It's such a schism. They're just such scared, pathetic people. It's just sad. Yeah, it's the woodwork, you know. This is the town fair coming to town, or the circus. And now, you know, they're all out of the woodwork now, and it's bright sun, and they're wiggling like a worm on the hot pavement. And that's how I see it. And I just, these guys are just ridiculous. They're ridiculous. I can't even believe anybody listens to them. I can't believe that anybody was sitting here even covering their pathetic little protests. You know, I mean, what was that? 1,000, 2,000 people? Now, I remember before the Iraq War, there were millions in the streets. And all I ever remember of that was, a couple people with signs. Oh, the anarchists are back. And, you know, they were, if they even discussed it, it would be totally downplayed. And this is nonsense. I mean, you know, they always talk about how they have this huge, huge majority of people and, you know, wind up with these little, these little, tiny little group gatherings of just, you know, just a few come in there, and you know, they all. You ever see this when they go in there with the cameras and they sit there and they interview these people and they're rocks are more intelligent. I mean, rocks are smarter than that. Right? It's just they're just ridiculous. They're sad. It's pathetic. They're the people that make us look bad to everybody. And I don't want to, you know. I mean, I don't know what we're gonna, you know. I don't know what we could do with them because they're too even afraid to get educated. They want to know now. They want to know if the president's cut or uncut. What the hell is this? Just get off of it. I mean, find something valid. That's all I'm asking. You know what? If he is a killer and a murderer, if he does these things, if Barack Obama is Dexter, you know, then find that. You know, go study him. Do something. I don't know. Just do something right. Just make it real and truthful and honest. I'm so sick of this.
Seek purpose in your existence. Yes, I know. Yeah. And you know what? I mentioned something at the start of the show, and since it's you and since it's us, this seems an appropriate time. John Fox dug this up so that we could share this based on my little the thing about Miley Cyrus thinking that Cracker Barrel is real food, it's real Southern food. But I invoke the name of, peace be upon him, Bill Hicks. And, you know, there's never a bad time in a conversation between you and me to run a little Bill Hicks.
Never.
But, you know, it all took place in Nashville, so that took me immediately to him. And just in terms of stupid people, because what you're talking about, Albert, is stupid people. You can't go wrong with Bill, so this won't take too long. Just you know, just for you, it's kind of like a long distance dedication.
Thank you, sir.
No one doubts my existence. Yeah, I've noticed a certain anti-intellectualism going around this country, man. Ever since around 1980, coincidentally enough, I was in Nashville, Tennessee last week, and after the show, I went to a Waffle House. Right, and I'm sitting there and I'm eating and I'm reading a book. I don't know anybody. I'm alone. I'm eating, and I'm reading a book. And this waitress comes over to me. What's he reading for? I said, wow, I've never been asked that. Not what am I reading, but what am I reading for? Well, goddamn it, you stumped me. I guess I read for a lot of reasons, but the main one is so I don't end up being a fucking waffle waitress.
But you know, it's that front end, Albert, that just murders me. Have you noticed that there's a rise in anti-intellectualism in this country these days? Started about 1980.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Yep. And it started. Yeah, it started bubbling. It started boiling in the, you know, well, had its simmer spots, but it really started bubbling in the 70s. You know, with their God's people come out of the closet, you know, and all that jazz, and you know, so now they are, and you know, the true light of day is seeing them for what they are. It made me laugh. I heard this crap on NPR, and they're like, you know, what was it? It was 53%. Some poll just came out. 53% support President Obama's plan, right? So 47% don't. Or 45, and then 2% are unsure. Whoever knows. Well, however that breaks down, but 53%, you know, support it, and then you know, almost half don't. You know, and then the very next question about people's exclusions. Like, do you think anybody should be excluded for, you know, previous conditions? It was like 80% didn't think that. So it's like, wait a minute. There's such a
great big honking disconnect that you could drive a semi-tractor trailer through sideways? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, it's like looking into the void. It's like, you guys are so stupid. I don't understand it. It's called, just have a little tiny, 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 tiny bit of integrity. You know, and this is why, you know, they can talk about President Obama's foreskin and all this jazz, and it's the same... this is the same game plan. You know, we were so scared of this juggernaut team. I remember this, how, oh my God, look at these guys. They run the same play every single time.
Yeah, but when Harry Reid's your defensive coordinator, he's always thinking, this next play, they're going to fool me and not run it.
See, you know what? Now that's a reason to be afraid. That's the reason to be afraid.
Well, Coach, it looks like they've run that up the gut thing. Let me check it. Yeah, 67 plays. Yeah, but I tell you what, you get it into the defense. Watch the sweep. What?
Yeah. We need some.
You know the old Statue of Liberty play. This is where you run the Statue of Liberty play. Right here, after the 64th up the gut.
Oh, man. I'll tell you, you know, we need some new leadership. I think it's due. You know, President Obama, in terms of the left, you know, the same, and maybe a little insane, but, you know, the left, you know, his approval is kind of going down with us. He's kind of pissing us off a little bit here and there, and it's kind of been one of these things that builds. We tend not to forget things. We remember when he said, you know, but we kind of knew why he had to say what he had to say about cannabis and the drug war and this and that. We kind of understood, well, he's, you know, first black president, can't kind of come out and say we're going to fix the economy by selling dime bags. He can't do that, and I understand that. I get it, but, you know, it's little things. It's the little.
No, it's the use of the phrase dime bag that did me. I haven't heard that, and you know, I haven't heard that since we were talking about Mrs. Bush, and we heard that her nickname at SMU was Dimebag Laura.
Nice. Oh, yeah, remember her? She's funny. She always reminds me of that lady that played. She's an excellent actor. Vera Drake? No, that was the movie she was in. She's an excellent actor. She reminds me of her, but because of how well she did. She was in the Harry Potter film where she was the headmistress.
Oh yeah. I know who you're talking about. She's Dame Somebody now.
Yeah, that lady reminds me of Laura. That's how I think Laura Bush would be in person. But anyhow, and I understand all these things, but we need Paul Krugman to be given something. He needs to be on this in this government. You know, he's called it pretty straight on, pretty honestly, and pretty decently. So he told us kind of what we needed to do, where we needed to go, and that would be a nice, nice little tip for the left wing, I think. I think if Paul Krugman was able to kind of, somebody was to hand him the wrench, you know, because that's what we're sitting here looking at. You know, we're sitting here looking at this broken machine, and every doofus in the world or every guy that, you know, owns an auto parts store is the one that's trying to fix this thing. Oh, yeah, we're going to need a new timing belt. And
oh, yeah, it's all W.C. Fields at the beginning of the bank, Dick, leaning over the limousine, saying, are your tires properly inflated?
Exactly.
Yeah. Hand me a shifting spanner.
Yeah, he needs to step. We need to get him in there. Somebody needs to put him back in place. And it's nice to see Howard Dean kind of, you know.
Howard's not backing down.
No, you gotta respect that. I mean, you know, and that's the other thing. You know, this, give me Howard Dean over Rahm any day. I don't care. That was one of the first real bitter pills with Obama was Rahm Emanuel. And then, it just didn't feel right to me. It didn't feel like, you know, he ran on change. And that's one of those things that, you know, I'd love to be able to ask him one day. You know, it's like, we obviously were sold change. We were sold change from the Bush administration and from the 80s. We wanted change from when this crap started in the 80s of anti-intellectualism. I mean, look at all the things that culminated with the Bush presidency. We sat here, looked at stem cells or no people and all this snowflakes and wars of aggression and torture and death squads and just unbelievable crap that you wouldn't even imagine, wouldn't even buy in a movie. There's all this crap that's now coming true, and it's all been proven, and now it's all fact, you know. So we're sitting here looking, we were told change. Well, you know, change means change, doesn't it? I mean,
word. Yeah, it doesn't mean chump change.
Yeah, it's a change of course, a change of direction, you know, and this is one of those things that I hope they don't lose that, you know, and then. You know, and once again, Fancy was right, you know, and I've, you know, kind of said it here and there, you know, this, the horn is like a little ember, in the movie Quest for Fire that was in that, you know, animal skull, and they were trying to get it back to their cave, you know, and they got their little ember, and they're keeping it going. And that's kind of what the horn is. And one day we'll get a nice roaring bonfire, but until that day, keep trying to, you know, keep the ember dry, people, and let's not forget what we're, what, you know. What
don't burn your fingers now.
Don't burn your fingers.
And even if you do, doesn't mean that it's possessed by demons and you should not fool with it.
Boy, oh boy. Nah, I don't know what we're going to wind up seeing. But I'll tell you what I am looking forward to. I'm looking forward to seeing Michael Moore's new movie.
Oh, I've seen the trailer. I've seen the trailer, and it's inspiring.
It looks pretty good. And, you know, Sicko, in my opinion, is, to me, one of his best. Because it was the one that he was a little bit raw with. And he didn't try to do no very fancy things. He did it, you know, he used his intellectual wit and all those other things for these interesting little, you know, turns and twists and turns and so on and so forth. But I saw where he stepped the bar up in terms of level of truth-telling. That, you know, that film didn't give the right wing as many bullets as they would have imagined or liked to have seen, you know, because he was experienced. He knew what he could kind of get away with now and what he can't. So I'd like to see even a more simplistic approach with this new film. And, you know, hopefully this gets people's conversations up and people start doing some research, and, you know, it won't take long. They'll come across, you know, that is one of those things when we say, well, we have capitalism, and we all know it's pitfalls and downfalls, but what do we do? We can't go, I mean, you know, and then, of course, you know, the capitalists, they get all afraid, and they get all scared. They think the minute you start talking about changing the system, that you want, you know, Soviet, you know, the Soviets back, and you want, you know, Bolshevism and all this other stuff, or, you know, I mean, they can't see anything else. It's like all they see is in black and white, and they see there's either or black and red, and they see this and that, and that's what they see, you know. They don't see that, you know, maybe we should change it for, I don't know, just a more resource-based economy. You know, maybe we should sit there and, you know, as a species, you know, if every single country, you know, kind of sat there and wrote constitutions and said, this is what we stand for, this is what we buy, I mean, this is what we believe, you know, while we're sitting here trying to repair this earth that we've done massive damage to, which is really our, you know, people keep saying, and I'll say it again, you know, people always say, and this is starting to bug me now, you know, because I'm not the only one. There's a bunch of other people out there that see this and bugs them as well. You know, this whole save the planet business. Screw the planet, save the species, and we'll save the species by saving the planet. You know what I mean? We have to sit here and save the species and look at it like that so we can get some progress in here. So like I was saying, in terms of if these countries came together with a built constitutions, why can't we just kind of, as a species, say, hey, we're human, this is what we stand for, and we've had, you know, many treaties, you know, we sit there in the toll torture, but let's reestablish it under a one unifying kind of constitution for just human life that's, I don't know, more widely distributed than what the UN Charter of Life is. You know what I mean? Something that, you know, everybody can kind of get involved with. Every country gets to say its little piece. Like, where do we want to be in 1,000 years? You know, if my household has to sit here and budget, why can't the species ever sit down at the table and budget? And, like, really budget and, like, have to... Like,
and by budget, we don't mean fiat money. We mean budget resources. We mean budget water, budget the minerals, budget... Yeah. Oh, look, budget carbon.
You know, in 12th grade, by the time, you know, it's you're not thinking about school and learning or the future of your life, and then you sit there and, you know, goals and learn, goals from moles, you know, I'm going to go out and have some fun. I'm sick of this school crap. So, but in reality, that makes sense. It makes sense to set goals and achieve them and do these things. So why doesn't the species, why don't we sit here and come together as the Earth and put together some, you know, just some goals of where we want to be? Do we want to be in space? Do we really want to do it? You know, if we're going to do it, wouldn't it make sense if we all did it together? I don't know. I mean, it's some, you know, sometimes you just got to laugh at how far we haven't come. Because it's kind of, it's just sad. It's just really sad sometimes. You know? And you know I got the optimism bug, but boy.
Well, you know, I was going to interrupt you, and I apologize just briefly because that comment about the optimism bug reminded me of something. Agnes and I have very few occasions where we sit like an old married couple and watch the TV box. But we had one of those rare instances last night. I was tired, she was tired, but everybody was asleep. And we very, very quietly and surreptitiously clickered the TV over to the local public television station, and we caught Nova. And we caught this piece on fractal geometry. And just the very nature of the word is enough to let me know that I'm way out of my depth. But the beauty of something like Nova is that they can take that and dumb it down enough so that, you know, English major me can get it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go watch that. I didn't know that was on.
It was fascinating. It was all kinds of fascinating. And the part that just got all over me like poison ivy was when they took, and they started it out, you know, slowly but surely, and they said, you know, explaining how cell phone antennas work now, and it's all based on fractal geometry.
Okay.
Which I'm hard pressed to explain, except to say that curves aren't smooth.
Yeah.
God only knows what that means. But they go through, okay, cell phone antennas, thing, and then they said, and in this research in the Amazon rainforest, we're discovering that, and it turns out that apparently tree limbs are based on fractal geometric patterns, and that the number of trees and shapes in a forest can be extrapolated to fractal geometry. And this is not, you know, this is not the same level of insanity as the guy from A Beautiful Mind finding secret messages from the Soviets in Highlights for Children.
Yeah, yeah.
And by doing that, they're down to, apparently this one research team is down to the point where they can calculate the amount of carbon captured by a leaf.
Interesting.
And they can extrapolate that over an entire forest, and based upon the shape of the forest within the fractal geometric form, they can see what happens when you unforest a forest. And they can thereby extrapolate out the whole carbon nightmare that we're facing right now.
I'm
sitting there with my brains turning to tomato soup. And I'm thinking, because the cool thing is that the cell structure inside the leaf matches the fractal geometry of the shape of the tree itself, and the shape of the tree matches the shape of the forest. And
oh, Bob, if we had the time and I had a bunch of papers in front of me, I'd probably present a pretty impressive argument regarding our whole existence.
And that was ultimately the thrust of this whole thing.
Sweet.
And at the same time, you know, and I turn to Agnes at the appropriate moment, and I say, "Dear Jesus, don't ever let a fundamentalist see this. Don't let the global warming deniers ever see this, because their little heads will explode." You know, that time machine, you know, Sherman set the Wayback Machine and all of that, Albert. I want to set it for me in eighth grade, and I want me now to stand behind me then. And every time my mind wanders during Algebra 1, I just want to slap me behind the back of the head like some sort of Zen monk and pay attention, grasshopper. Because I would give my left nut to have the ability to comprehend that stuff. Because if I did, then maybe someday, somewhere, somehow, I wind up in an elevator with Don Blankenship again. And I get to look at him and say, "So, you global warming denying freak, you, explain fractal geometry." And I get to watch his little head explode. Or his thugs beat the piss out of me, or, you know, something like that.
He'd probably just, his little mustache would lift up, and then some a little dart would shoot in your neck, and you'd just...
Sleepy time.
Yep.
See you, Dom.
You know, a fella goes around taking pictures around here, liable to get shot. Yeah, that's easily translatable to fella goes around talking about fractal geometry around here, liable to get shot.
But what a mind-opening...
Well, we won't talk about my misspent youth and my early years in college and the substances that were involved with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't... I guess I got to watch more.
There for a while.
I got to sneak off and watch more PBS more often.
My husband's a PBS junkie. Help me, Ricky. Anyway, sorry. It's a beautiful place that we happen to be sharing at the moment. So, you know, I kind of think, you know, I take the opposite approach. I'd like to dump that on them, just wash over them. You know, you just, I've said this a million times, they don't have anything grounding underneath them. You know, they're reaching for foreskin, Bob. I mean, you know, when we start talking about fractal geometry and the impact of, and if you can attribute it to trees and leaves and forests, of course it's going to be the same thing to humans and the foods we eat. And I mean, it's just, you know, it's a secret of the universe here, and we're starting to discover it at the right time for people that are, you know, ready for the change, to change and change for the better, not change for the worse. You know, so that's why, you know, they're fighting that the whole step of the way. You know, they want to pull it back to the 50s. You know how it is. You know, these guys they live a nostalgia for a day that never even existed. And that's their problem. You know, so... Yeah, fractal geometry might slap a little sense into them. You know, I don't know. I don't know, brother. These guys, what are you going to do with them, you know? It's just ridiculous.
Geometry doesn't even sound like a real world word, does it?
That's got a nice room in my heart, that whole scene. it's a crazy, crazy thing. It's just look at a tree. Just look at it. Just look at it for a while and let that word roll around in your head. Fractal geometry. And, you know, there's a little Java applet out there, and it's called the Powers of 10. Just go check that out. That's awesome. That's the same thing. It pulls way back 100,000 light years away, and it comes in by a factor of 10 every time. Boom, 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 until it reaches the inner, you know, nuons and gluons of the nucleus of a carbon atom. You know, and yeah, you'll see. Most of what an atom is empty space. Most of where we are is empty space. Most of what we're made of is empty space. We're kind of this, you know, little electromagnetic, you know, little computer that kind of runs around this world. And, you know, there's those of us that do the Hal Turner thing and stir the pot and for powers that be, you know, and that's a disturbing thing. You think about that for a second. Did you hear about this guy, Hal Turner?
Oh, yeah.
This thing's been bumping around my head for, you know, a couple of days now. And it's really disturbing because that guy said some really vile, hideous, disgusting stuff. And he was paid to do it. And he's stirring up the, like, you know, he's playing with matches in the powder room. You know, he's the stupid sailor on the main smoking his pipe in the powder keg room. And he's ridiculous. And this guy's sitting here stirring up the racist freaks of the world in this country, you know, the American Taliban. He stirs these guys up into their racial purity, ethnic purity, all this other stuff. And he was getting paid for it. The FBI wanted him to do this stuff. Now we need change from that. This COINTEL crap that, you know, everybody, oh, and, you know, granted, the people that Alex Jones is probably one of these guys. Yeah, you, who knows? Who knows who these guys are, that they're these, you know, COINTEL agents, and they're, what's the other word, agent provocateurs.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That go and break the windows, and they're the ones that kind of stir up this crap. And you know, and they warn us about the shackles and the chains that are going to shackle us, right? And this is one of those things. If you, I pay attention to as many different news sources as I as I can. You know, I try to stay away from the real filth, but, you know, I try to pay attention to as many as I can. And, you know, so, yeah, you know, you hear Alex Jones over the years and all. He was railing against Clinton in the death camps and all that other stuff. And then Bush came, and, oh, you have to get him, too. And all, so, man, yeah, that Bush is doing some...
Yeah, and the funny thing is all liberals, while he was busy hating on Bush, all the liberals go, this Alex Jones, he's pretty cool. He'll like it, Bush.
Well, and that's kind
and
of
then, and then and then in abject horror they turn. He don't like Obama neither, and then they find he didn't like Clinton. He don't like nobody. He's Mikey.
That's how he sells money. I mean, that's how he sells money. That's how he makes his money. So he sells his DVDs. You know, it's actually the very same formula that the government certainly does use that he's pointing out, but he's using the very same formula that he points out them using. Right, you cause a problem, right? You give them you make a reaction come up, and you know, and then you give them the solution, and you keep just doing that and selling them, and you get DVDs for 1995, and you know, and then you get Wars of Aggression on a larger scale of the fractal, you know, and that's the fractal geometry fits in this too. I mean, it's, you know, we got to just sit there and really, literally write down what it is we want to see in this world. Write it down as a species, I don't know, maybe some. I don't know, man. Humanitarian groups. I don't even know who the hell would wind up putting this. It's a big image, but this is something that we should. Yeah, I heard her, honey. Anyhow, you know, this is just something that we need to wind up doing, just so we know where we need to go, just so we can sit there and look in a different direction than constantly looking, you know, for evidence of sexual misconduct and constantly looking for all this stuff. And yeah, we need to, you know, we need to go, we're going here for our vacation, or we're going here for our future. This is where we're going. That's it. End of story. This is where we're going. This is what we got to save for. You know, we're going for energy sustainability. We're going for, you know, reducing the level of pollution in our water. Yeah, okay, it's going to clean the fish up. Oh no, then, you know. And I'll tell you another thing. You know what I'd really, really like to see, and I know this would probably never happen. I mean, Jesus would probably fly out of the sky before this would happen, but I would like to see a moratorium on all fishing in the oceans. I'd like to give the ocean like a 2-year break. Just like 2 years of just, hey, all right, stop. Let me relax. Let me get some fish stock up, you know. Because you're sitting there, you know, you're watching PBS. I tend to always watch those documentary shows. You know, and you sit there and you really look, you know, when this is modern stuff. They're still going out there, and there's still, you know, 500 million fish just sitting there doing their little, you know, their trouts back up the river and stuff. I mean, those kinds of things just blow me away that these freaking fish know exactly where they need to go to sit there and lay their little eggs so they can, and they'll do anything. It doesn't matter. Bears and cougars, and it doesn't matter who's there, and dams, they jump over. I mean, they'll do as much, as long as it's not impossible, they'll do it. They'll, you know, it doesn't matter if the stream dries up, they'll flip and flapple all the way up the stream, up until they get to the spot where they were born. You know, and we need that kind of commitment to our species, I think. I mean, we need that. We need to sit there and learn from, you know, these lesser life forms that we, you know, want to sit there and put capital gains on.
Lesser. Lesser. He said lesser. Lesser life forms. No, but
no, I did it with quotes. You didn't hear my.
No, I did. I'm being a smartass. But you know that reminds me of something that I got from News Ninja Gene the other day. Albert, he sends me this story, and you know, remember, Gene reads the entire internet every day. And it's this story about how fishing in the future will be done, and you know, not like the George Jetson future that was already supposed to be here, but isn't. Never mind. But, you know, the not-too-distant future, fishing will be done by gigantic robot ships.
Mm.
No,
I
please.
Hope we have factories.
Please,
I hope we have
no.
Of factories making fish. Yeah.
Soylent fish?
You know, all right, you want to do some robotic fishing, I guess that's, I don't know, is everybody else going to be busy building the evacuation ships, the Titans, and all the other things that we need to build to get off the planet and get to another star system? Or we better start pumping that oil if we're going to get there in time. Yeah, that's another thing right-wingers need to really sit there and be dunked into, is the magnitude, you know, this is also the magnitude of numbers. And how big a light year is, and how far the nearest star is. You know, that's one of those things, and that I don't think anybody really, really grasps. But it's one of those things that they need to be just christened with or sprinkled on or something. They need to sit here and understand that. Yeah, go ahead. They need to sit there and understand that, you know, God, whatever, you know, this is our only planet. You know, and I don't always see this because it always seems to me like the, I mean, even my family, and you know, he's a hunter and this and that, and you know, these people, they try to care, but I do kind of plant my seeds, and I've been planting seeds into that rocky mountainscape for a while. So he does kind of pay attention a little bit to, you know, nice efficiencies and R50. You know, like they don't, you know, they'll sit there and rail on Acorn while I sit there and say, hey, you know, if only we'd get a stimulus check to, you know, up the insulation of every house to R50 and put solar panels on every roof, you know. Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, but even that, you know, so, but then at the same time, it's Acorn, and then just stupid little things that they make. But anyhow, I'm sorry. But
that's okay. No, it's Acorn.
I just wonder why they always seem to be the ones that, you know, it's like they can't, it's like they never want to even, you know, they grab onto something and never ever let it go. They just want to hold on to it until it drags into the bottom of the ocean. You know, they never know when to let go of something. And, you know, and sometimes I guess it'll work, but I don't think it's going to work in this. You know, well, there's a whole lot of stupid out there, Bob, but there's a whole lot of people waking up as well. There is. I'm one of them. I'm a stupid idiot, you know, and I know that, you know, but at the same time.
No, but you just isolated it, Albert. You're willing to acknowledge what you don't know. The vast majority of this country does not, for a variety of reasons, want to acknowledge that they don't. Because we have a culture that tries to make people feel like, how do you say this without sounding like an elitist? You know, I acknowledge that I'm too stupid to fully comprehend fractal geometry. Because plane geometry is something that is still, you know, a step beyond me. Never mind trig. But we've got this thing that happens in the media, especially the for-profit media, where, you know, you don't, for instance, you don't actually have to buy the Nordic track and actually use the Nordic track. You buy the Nordic track and set it prominently in your home and let it gather dust and think about using the Nordic track while you're holding the French onion dip and the bag of potato chips over on the couch. And that's okay. That's all right, because they sold their Nordic track and you know, with only 20 minutes a day. And as long as you can keep sitting there on the couch, trust me, as a guy who owns potato chips and onion dip, I know, you can sit there on the couch and keep thinking, well, hell, it's only 20 minutes a day. I'll start tomorrow.
Yep.
And by the same token, you know, look, and I know that it may not necessarily be your bag, Albert, but, you know, we all understand that I have this little sports geek problem. And if you have ever, and you really should, because you live in a state where it matters. When NFL season rolls around, tune in some local AM station that carries the statewide Packers babble.
Yep.
And
yep.
You will.
Yes.
And because I think the sporting world is probably there's no better example. Call in or listen to the people call in and say, well, I think if they just had cover two going on right there, it wouldn't have ended the way it ended.
Yeah, they can remember I remember back in 86 when he threw three interceptions in a, you know.
Well, see, he's got the linebackers playing 7 yards off the ball instead of five. That's a good 3 steps, and that's all the time that Peyton Manning needs to chew you to pieces.
Yeah, they get all Rain Man with the sports, but anything, ask them anything else, and that damn Brit.
But no, the thing is, they're not even experts on that, because there's some real guy who's, yeah, I mean, when you look at the lives that a head football coach leads, or a defensive coordinator, or an offensive coordinator, or any of those guys, you know, they live on like 4 hours of sleep. They're analyzing film at 3 o'clock in the morning, and this is college and pro. Okay, and those guys know things about the individual porcine dimples on the footballs. But we've created a culture
where everybody really, really does know or has been told they know. You know, we've got fantasy football leagues, and we've got the I don't know, hot pot the baseball leagues, and everybody, and it extends. Look at the celebrity news culture. Well, you know, I couldn't believe what. Look at what I started the program with, for Christ's sakes, a story about Miley Cyrus taking some poor Aussie boy to Cracker Barrel and telling him that was Southern cooking when it's freaking corporate cooking. But we're all experts, and we don't have to do the hard work and the heavy lifting of actually trying to come to terms with the facts involved with any given thing that we're talking about. And the contrary is the beauty of what happens here, because you have people, all of us, while we may acknowledge what we don't know, that doesn't mean that we excuse ourselves from attempting to know it.
Yes, sir.
And it has nothing to do with what Miley Cyrus is having for lunch.
No. You know, I saw on the Huffington, I was at the Huffington Post just checking some news and seeing this and that. And, of course, you know, in the big picture on the side is Sean Penn and his wife having problems. And I was going to click on it to just put a comment to the person, you know, whatever, and say, you know what, do we really care? Do we really care? But I didn't even want to give it any attention, so I didn't even want to click on it.
Yeah, that's just another whisper you didn't want to put in the universe's ear.
There you go. Yeah, I didn't want to, oh, well, you know, he says he doesn't care, but he clicked it, you know. That's a page click, and that's good marketing right there. Is the.
Oh, you're going for the angry dollar. That's a good dollar.
That's a good dollar. Oh, and hey, before we get going here, I want to ask you, how did you enjoy your sandwich? Was it Pickerman's, right?
No. Oh, you mean the Permane Brothers?
Yeah, Permane. There we go.
Yeah, that turned out to be the cheapest meal in downtown Pittsburgh. And it's magnificent stuff. You know, the original joint is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So when you get off of a, when you get done with a 20-hour day at Netroots Nation, you can walk 8 long blocks up Penn Avenue and turn left on 18th, and you know they're there, and the Iron City's ice cold, and the sandwich is $6, and they're magnificent. They're just wonderful. Don't ask them to put the mayo on. Don't ask them to put the mustard on. Let them make the sandwich the way they make the dadgum sandwich, and they will happily provide you with packets of mustard and mayonnaise or ketchup even. You know, don't tell them you want it. The guy that was working the grill the evening that Guy and I were there, along with Matt Osborne, had a T-shirt on that showed Bender from Futurama, and it said on the back, it said "Special orders get me bent." You know, it may very well be the most beautiful specialty sandwich in all of the northeastern United States, if not the United States itself. Although, you know, I kind of hold a special place in my heart for the muffaletta in New Orleans. Let them be what they're good at. And I'm sitting there, and you know, Guy's sitting there just looking at me in googly eyed wonder because I'm getting. I've finished sandwich one, and I'm working on sandwich two because I was hungry. That's no breakfast, no lunch, and you know, late dinner. Part of this good, healthy, nutritious breakfast. And lo and behold, with this guy's back to her, that you know, the special orders get me bent, comes up and says, "I want my sandwich, but I want mayonnaise and I want mustard on it, and I don't want any French fries on the side. I don't want any French fries on the sandwich. I want the French fries on the side." It was like the scene from When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah.
Only I thought the guy behind the counter was gonna bust open an Iron City long neck and see what she had for lunch. Because he ain't got the pad out and he's not writing it down. You know, the only thing he's written down is corned beef.
Yeah.
And it's going to happen over there. And, you know, Precious Lumpkin can take the damn fries off. And if she doesn't come back, that's okay, because there's a million people who will.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm actually we're kind of planning to go and visit the great grandparents, and they're in New Jersey, and go see some family in New York. You know, we'll see if we can do it. But I'm thinking we might take a little diversion. I'm thinking I just want to stop and get one. You know, it's a road trip goal of mine to stop there and get one of those sandwiches. Mm-mm-mm. They look like a tasty sandwich. And when you said you were going to get one, I just had to know.
Well, if you ever get there, you'll understand. But there's a couple of great sandwich joints in the. Yeah, there's a grinder joint somewhere in Jersey that is very well spoken of, and ooh, it looked good when I saw it.
Yeah, there's all kinds of. That's what the Travel Channel and the other one. They got all them crazy food porn shows on, and I kind of, you know, Netflix has them. I kind of checked a few of them out, made me laugh, and then, you know, it was actually the week I saw the one with. I saw two. And in one week, I saw two shows with about the same exact sandwich joint, and then you said about it, and I'm like, wow, this is the universe telling me I have to have one of these, so.
Yeah, receive the message. Receive the message, Albert.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, I will.
All right, you take care, brother. Great talking to you.
Always, always. All right, man, we'll talk with you later.
All right, later. Brother Albert the Sage of Southwest Wisconsin. And another far-ranging conversation. A couple of, before we go on with the phones, a couple of more notes from the mailbag. Our buddy David in Tennessee says, you know, too stupid? You know, you mean along the lines of don't confuse me with facts, my mind is made up? We have this blizzard of right-wing media telling people, if you find what you thought was fact 23 years ago is not the truth now, you have fallen victim to moral relativism. Go back to basics. And, you know, so much of that was born, a big chunk of it was born right here in West Virginia, because they're celebrating like the 25th or the 35th or the 30th, or God knows if that you can even count, anniversary of the great Kanawha County book debate. When, at a time before the right wing ever really, really had its shoes on, the right wing got real hardcore and violent and started putting rocks through windows and stuff. Because they didn't want our children reading that smut in school. And, I mean, people stop talking to each other over that stuff. Really. Moral relativism in our textbooks. And speaking of which, just to let you know, let's take a quick trip to Texas. The Texas State Board of Education, you know, any sentence that begins with Texas State Board of Education is not going to end well. They have a review committee, and they're voting on a draft of proposed standards for history textbooks. Oh, Jesus, get their hands off the history. The Houston Chronicle filed a story noting that the draft has nothing about liberals. That's their quote, not mine. And it follows and says, the first draft for proposed standards in United States history studies since Reconstruction. Says students should be expected, and this is a quote from the Texas State Board of Education Review Committee draft, students should be expected, quote, to identify significant conservative advocacy organizations and individuals, such as Newt Gingrich, Phyllis Schlafly, and the Moral Majority. Meanwhile, other people involved in the drafting have proposed adding that Flush Flimball and the National Rifle Association also be added to United States history studies since Reconstruction. The committee is, of course, stacked with 10 Republican right-wingers, and the 10 outnumber the other 5 semi-normal people. This goes hand-in-hand with the previous report that we talked about on this program, where wingnuts proposed that biographies of George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Stephen F. Austin, and Cesar Chavez be removed, and adding history about the motivational role of the Bible and the Christian faith, and the role they played in the settling of the original colonies.
That would be funny if Texas was about the size of Rhode Island. But Texas, by virtue of its size and its buying power, has the ability to shape how textbooks will be written for students from Maine to New Mexico and all points in between. When I think that in a few short years, my precious grandchildren may be bringing their history book home so that Opa can look at it, and I open it up, and I see that there's a chapter test at the back of it asking my precious Loney to explain how Newt Gingrich, Phyllis Schlafly, and the moral majority shaped America. I fear for that day. I fear for that day. Because I'm doing my dead level best to make sure that those precious little ones never see Opa's bad, dark side. But I fear on that day, if it comes home in that book, they're going to see it with neon flashing lights around it. Honey, can you tell me who George Washington was?
No, Opa, I don't know who he was. But Rush Limbaugh is a great man, and it's so sad he's just died. And I think we should send flowers.
God, I'm glad there's not a camera in this room because I am getting a verbal or a facial tic. A little muscle in my cheeks just going brrrt, brrrt, brrrt at the mere thought of it. I kid you not. The vote will be 10-5. And they will approve standards for United States history studies since Reconstruction that identify significant conservative advocacy organizations and individuals such as Newt Gingrich, Phyllis Schlafly, and the Moral Majority. And there may damn well be a unit that talks about how the National Rifle Association made America great. Anybody ever seen the Woodstock movie? Don't eat the brown acid. I think it's in the coffee urns at the Texas Board of Education. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
You know what you need to get is you need to get a double down sandwich.
You will have to define.
Oh, you haven't heard about this. Well, apparently KFC has decided to come up with a new sandwich. And I'm not making this up when I say they've decided to replace the bread. They use two pieces of fried chicken. That's what.
No, you just stop it.
Wait, it gets better. They put bacon and sauce in the middle. But now, see, this is the revealing part for the people who didn't pay attention to the story. Here's the revealing part, because they previewed it in two states, and it's two states that make me go, well, I would have guessed somewhere else because I'm a stereotypical bastard. What states do you think that they let this?
Wait. This is bacon and sauce slapped between two slabs of chicken.
Yeah, or what they call chicken.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Oh, you know the easy one for me. I'd test market it in. Here, let's just jump out and be real stereotypical. I'd test market it in Arkansas and West Virginia.
No, Nebraska and Rhode Island. And that makes me think, holy cow, how did they come to that decision?
No, the Nebraska, I can get down with the Nebraska one. That actually makes some small degree of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But...
The Rhode Island?
Rhode Island?
That's what I said. You know what I thought about? I thought about when people were talking about why people are going after fatty foods. They had this conversation on, Tom Hartman's program. And they said to fill the void of emotional emptiness. And I think the people...
No, that's to fill the void of arterial emptiness.
that too. I mean, but that's part of the reasons why they were talking about why people would want something that bad for you and that fattening, because you can never fill the void. So you think if you get something that is supposedly not good for you, but tastes really good according to the marketers and branders, then maybe this time you'll be full, and you found your.
I mean, Jesus, Dagwood Bumstead with his Dagwood sandwiches wasn't that disgusting. Who's working in the test kitchen at KFC, David?
I don't know, but I think this really does point back to. I think a lot of liberals and progressives are so. I don't think the light is on where the critical thinking comes for America, where they talk about where they try to say that health concerns are on the rise. Well, I think that's what the media says, but I think most people are doing the stupid thing, Bob. I think most people are going to the KFC. I guarantee there's some people right now calling KFC going, "Don't you dare! Don't you dare let this sandwich be banned! Don't you dare!"
I mean, this is something that I would expect to see Bobby eating on the King of the and Hank eating on King of the Hill. This is my judge material.
You know what I think it is? I think KFC saw Idiocracy, and they saw the Carl's Juniors, and they said, "We got to step it up, boys."
We're behind the curve.
Yeah, we're behind the curve. I don't know. I mean. But you see, they still haven't decided to go if they're going to go with the 50 states. I think it's too much of an outrage. Believe it or not, I think it's too much of a devolution deal.
No. They're just going to perfect the recipe in Nebraska and Rhode Island.
If this
news gets out, it'll be the hottest thing since sliced grits in West Virginia. Oh my God. And I say that as a West Virginian, okay? I mean, look. Because you know what? They knew. They knew when they put that thing together. They knew that they couldn't test market it in, you know, anywhere in central, in South Central fried America. And frankly, you know what? Maybe the other reason, David, is because here in this region, you know, although we do eat very poorly, we do still have, Lord knows, Alabama, Mississippi, Kentucky, Tennessee, Georgia, West Virginia, Virginia. We still do have those women who will beat your ass, or at least give you a thorough, a sound talking to that'll make you wish they had in the first place for suggesting that any restaurant food can be better than theirs. You know, if this news has reached Berkeley, California, Michael Pollan is having a stroke. But the fact of the matter is, this isn't going to be marketed to rural America. This is going to be marketed as all bacon things are, and all fried chicken things are, and fried this, and it's not marketed to folks who, I mean, it is, but not. No, this is something that they sell in the city to people on the go so that they can think that they're eating something home style. And it makes me crazy. It just makes me nuts.
I also think that America needs to learn when to stop, and they need to, you know, take more time to fix something at home rather than just to go run out to KFC. And I know that's a little bit of a hard step for America, but I think that's what needs to happen. And also, I think there needs to be that talk about what is the new nuclear, I guess that's what I'll call it, the nuclear fast food, the thermo fast food, going to do to our society in terms of health if they step it up 4 or 5 more notches.
What direction do those notches turn, David?
Well, I think we all know the answer to that. I'm telling you something. I saw something absolutely just crazy on YouTube. This woman, I think her channel is called Sinfully Sarah or something, and she was making a macaroni salad. Good Lord, Bob. The stuff she put in the salad, it didn't make any sense. It's like, and all of the comments on the message board that I picked it up is like, you don't have to put that in there. Why is she putting that in there? And it looked like a swamp when she was born. I was like, where's Bayou Billy?
I have heard macaroni salads, and there are many permutations referred to as many different things, and a lot of them suck. But I have never heard macaroni salad described as looking like a swamp.
I'm telling you something. When I saw it, I was in disbelief. But I just wanted to open that some levity to the program. I wanted to talk about I just got done watching IOUSA, and there were some particular parts in it. I also watched the extras, and for those people who don't have time for the extras, then I'm your man because I can tell you some of the crazy shit I've heard. And one of the crazy shit things I heard was Warren Buffett was on the panel. Or Warren Buffet, as most Americans probably can
we got lunch. We got lunch buffets, Sunday buffet, all you can eat buffet, and Warren Buffet.
And he said, and this is part of the problem where you're talking about how capitalism has become a religion. And he said, I think people underestimate that they don't realize that the pie will continue to get bigger. And I kept thinking to myself, we live in a finite world, not an infinite world. And this guy is telling us, don't worry, the pie will get bigger. I think really what they're doing is like it's a they're filling it up with pie substitute, and they're spinning it around real fast. And that's why the pie is always full and always been full, because it's a, you know it, and I know it. This is the biggest scam. This is a hoax. And anyone who believes that, I think deep down they feel guilty inside. Someone like Warren Buffett, I did it, Warren Buffett. And someone like Warren Buffett feels a little bit guilty for having this much wealth, which I think a lot of people should be when people are suffering to this degree. But I can't, but Bob, try to have that wrapped around your head. The pie will always continue to get bigger. So we have more people, and
yeah, because we, you know, we're imagining the pie.
Yeah, and I like to also, they also had, you never, I can't believe this. They had they invited one of the Cato Institute's executives on the panel, and one of the guys from the so-called left. Jumped up and said, he goes, I don't think, and he completely nailed why you shouldn't privatize Social Security, and it left the Cato guy speechless. But I mean, I wanted to see Warren with a Pope hat when he was making those claims. So that's why it kind of was kind of eerie when you were talking to who was it? Sandra was talking about it with being a religion, or
that conversation went all the way from Sandra down all the way through Albert. Yeah,
right. It's a continuous weaving, as they say. And but the thing to me that struck me very interesting about the whole process about when they were talking about the deficit and when they were talking about the debt and all of that was. How literally we continue to fall for these promises year after year after year, no matter how much information we have. And it really does come to down to what I love the term, what David Walker says, it's a fiscal cancer, and there needs to be something done about it. And he said we're 62% on autopilot on this government, which would make a lot of sense considering what's going through. You know, when you look at something like with Afghanistan, and I don't know if you caught Jeremy Scahill. I mean, that's surreal to see Jeremy Scahill on a panel with Chuck Todd. Who would ever think to see a Chuck Todd and Jay Leno? And here is Bill Maher letting him get 10 minutes in of what he wants to say about Blackwater. And I was just, And I just thought to myself, I said, there must be some stupid Democrats up on Capitol Hill trying to say, what are we going to do about Scahill? We got to do something about Scahill. We got to get a critic to silence him now. Because nobody wants to nobody wants to admit that about Afghanistan. Nobody wants to admit that about the Vatican military base. Nobody wants to admit about the torture allegations, which, oh, by the way, one thing that somebody, that nobody picked up on was, which they should pick up on, is the power drill incident of the torture victim.
Yeah.
That comes from a 24 episode. And if you go back 4 years, I told you about that article in the New Yorker about the executive producer of 24.
Oh, God, yeah, I remember that conversation.
Right. So this is full circle. This is what I was saying when I saw, well, why, where would they get the idea about the power drill? And if you look, now I know it sounds like a conspiracy theory, but if you look in the, into a lot of the new torture experiments, it's coming straight from a show like this with the episodes and the sequences they've done. And,
you know, I remember when I used to say more frequently than I do now, David, but I used to say, talking to the Bush administration, these dumb bastards have read Catch-22 and thought it was and thought it was nonfiction, or that they had watched Dr. Strangelove and thought it was a documentary. And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, it is.
They took their they literally took their reality from from an imaginary world, because, you know, a television script or a television world, because in the right wing world, imaginary stuff, you know, because after all, as was noted earlier in the program, they believe that their forebears were talked to by snakes. The imaginary is as real to them as reality is itself. You know, they've got a Tinkerbell faith. They've got a Tinkerbell approach to Afghanistan. You know, if we only believe we can win in Afghanistan, we can. And, you know, Mary Martin goes flying across the stage and talks to imaginary, you know, Dick Cheney goes flying across the stage and talks to an imaginary, an imaginary Hamid Karzai, who tells them that everything is just hunky-dory and all the women in beekeeper suits that, you know, are doing their, in Afghanistan, are doing their best Ethel Merman impression and singing Everything's Coming Up Poppies. But that's the way they operate. So of course they would take stuff from they would take their cues from a TV show.
You know,
of course they
goes,
would.
It all goes full circle. I mean, even in the article, if people haven't read it, it was an interesting read on the world of Joel, who created 24, and he was invited up to Dick Cheney's place, and Dick Cheney confessed that it was his favorite show. So, I mean, if you ever wonder why we hired Blackwater, just look at how 24 is set up. Just look at how everything in the TV series that you would you would want from a perspective of somebody who's in government who believes an authoritarian stance on terror. This is where it comes from. And if you listen to talk radio, if you did turn on right-wing talk radio and they were talking about terrorism at that point, they would do the same type of narrative, the same exact type of talking points and frame, so literally to make you feel guilty that you can't argue the opposite direction. And that's what ends up happening, and why a lot of people don't end up taking it on, and why people like Jeremy Scahill is blowing the whistle as hard as he can and saying, I'm not letting the Obama administration skate by. In fact, this is where they're going to have the torture prisons here, and this Vatican-sized embassy is not going to do anything more but disrupt the whole region. And I'd like to tell you some more about Blackwater, why they're still on the payroll. I mean, he was going on and on that Jay Leno section, and Chuck Todd had nothing to say. But it was funny how they gave him time, and you would just expect someone to say, "What are you talking about? You're letting everything just go to the wayside." Because one of the reasons he says it was, "Oh, we got really mad." He said, "I don't understand all this." He goes, "Because you know what's going to happen? This is going to end up in court, and you're not going to get the results you want. What happens if you don't get the result you want in this government? And he just kept going on and on. And that's the problem. And then Jeremy did the shutdown, and this is very important. He said, because it sets a precedent for what we consider to be guilty crimes and torture, I'm not that naive to think that anyone is going to get arrested or thrown in jail. And that kind of was like a shutdown argument right there, because he didn't have anything to say after that. And that's really what people need to do instead of, as much as I'd like some people to get arrested, and as much as I'd like to see people get handcuffed and sent to The Hague and be on trial, it's obviously not going to happen. Dick Cheney's going to have his book tour, and the complicit media is going to let this guy go. Can you imagine when this book does come out? It's going to be like a horror show, because they're going to let him speak, and they're going to let him speak his talking points, and nobody's going to take him to task on anything he says, because they're afraid of him. He set that. See, that's the thing, Bob. He set that precedent where you will be afraid of me, because this is how I answer questions. When he asked the question about, you know.
Oh, yeah. Look, you want another movie reference?
Yeah.
It's Darth Vader who kills you by looking at you. Right?
Yeah. Or if you really, I always saw Cheney as pretty much the emperor. you need to put a.
Well, he can do that. He can do that dark side trick too. He just puts his hand out, and the next thing, somebody's bloody beating heart is in his hand, and they, well, look what I got. You die. You know, boom. God, there's a merger between fiction and fact in right wing world. And they're very, very good at conveying that merger to the for-profit media. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it's completely fair. But I also think, the left, in terms of where it comes to the issue of the war on terror and torture, and pretty much any issue that any normal human being should be concerned about, you should show some empathy and show some logic and common sense where it comes to being an imperial superpower and having private militaries, for God's sake, becking at your will and trying to pretend like it doesn't exist. There's something seriously wrong with that.
Yep, very much so. David, I'm going to roll on, but great. Wow. From meat sandwiches.
Yeah.
To Emperor Palpatine.
Emperor Palpatine. Oh, one last thing I wanted to say was you really should check out, I don't know if anyone has recommended to you, but District 9, you should really check out that.
No, I'm hearing so many good things about that. I'm a gotta.
Check out for a link later tonight.
All right, cool.
All right, later.
All right, later, David. Pop culture correspondent David from Maine. And, you know, just because I am who I am, I don't know which scares me more. The two hunks of almost chicken sandwich or the Cheney stuff. Now, I guess that marks me as incredibly shallow. There is plenty to be afraid of in the Cheney stuff. Let's do go back to the mailbag for a minute. Our pal Allison up in Idaho said, with regard to our earlier conversation about taste buds and children and formative years, one of those profound moments that happens here on the Horn with such frequency that it makes a mockery of the for-profit media. Allison says, Bob, I've mentioned before that I love to hear you talk food, but there's a bit of a story behind why. First of all, you and Fancy have hit the nail on the head. Childhood has so much to do with how we eat as adults, and I know this firsthand. As a small child, my parents grew most of our food, as we lived on a ranch. My fondest memories of childhood are the hours I spent in the garden since I could walk, picking vegetables and berries, right from the vines and eating them. Fast forward to when I was 12 and my parents divorced. My mom and I left the ranch and she had to support me on her own. I lived on fast food and freezer dinners until high school, when I realized my body didn't compete with the other girls. I became very self-conscious. But I thought everyone ate fast food, and there was something wrong with me because I didn't look like them. Yeah, I was a bit chubby. I decided that they either ate the way I did and exercised their butts off, or didn't eat at all. So I chose both. Once hospitalized at barely 90 pounds, a loss of 50 pounds in 2 years, I began to learn how to really eat in treatment. I worry every time I see parents buying their children junk at the grocery store. My heart breaks for the little girls I see, especially, because I know how hard it was to come back from that pit of despair and confusion about food. Our society, its adults, corporations, and schools included, is made for what happened to me to happen to others. Thank you, Allison. I can't add to that. I mean, we talk joyously about food on this program because it's a convivial link to earnest humanity, regardless of how or where you're sharing it. But once again, the anarcho-randianists got hold of something good and something decent and something sustaining and nutritious and turned it into something vile and evil and dark and frightening. The food shouldn't be confusing. But in the mind of a pubescent or adolescent girl, it can be a bigger pitfall than drugs. And that's in large part by design. I'm trying to think, was it Spain a few years back that forbade any model on any fashion show runway that had a body mass index of less than like 18 or something? Because they recognized that it was killing their young girls? It's actually rather forward-thinking, by my way of looking at things. It takes courage to share a story like that, and I am unspeakably proud of the fact that a story like that, and stories like that, stories imply unreality. Accounts like that that are shared here on the Horn. I dare and defy you to find very many other places where that happens. Emily writes in and says, "Now, Emily, we're going to have to break you of this Mr. Kincaid business." Hi, Mr. Kincaid. No, Bob, please, Bob. Emily says, "I used to like Alex Jones, but now, of course, I know better and started questioning him with his documentary on Bohemian Grove. I saw shortly after I found out about him. One thing I don't get. He claimed the place is very top security and all that, with political world leaders who come for secret meetings. Wouldn't you think then there would be top security there because of all those world leaders, even if the leaders aren't there? In his video, he claims he got in by saying that he was with the Bush family because of his accent. If that's true, wouldn't the Bushes have had a list of people to let in, or they would call the Bushes to let them know that somebody was there? You see him walking around and nobody says anything to him. I don't see any security around or anything. They didn't show him getting in. I saw this recent documentary called New World Order, and of course Jones was involved. He would claim people were following him and all this other stuff. You know, watching an Alex Jones video is a lot like watching the Blair Witch Project. You remember that little film phenomenon a few years back? He would claim people were following him. That was me, not Emily. He would claim people were following him and all this other stuff, but he never showed that happening. It's kind of like Greek drama, you know, where where Oedipus's wife Yocasta hangs herself, but she does it off stage, and Oedipus takes Yocasta's brooch and gouges out his own eyes with his own hand and blinds himself, but he does it off stage. But that's me too. That's not Emily. Emily says, once he was at a hotel where supposedly some people with Bilderbergers were staying at the next day, and he's in his hotel room and got back from somewhere supposedly, and the fire alarm was going off. He was claiming it's because they know he's here, and they're scared of him, and that he supposedly talked to a staff person there, and this unseen person agreed with him. Remember, Yocasta hanging offstage, deus ex machina. Of course, this person wasn't shown on camera. Emily says you should try to find that film if you're interested in paranoia and to have a good laugh. Oh, and at one point, Jones and his group are making a ruckus in New York City, and he's warned to stop, if they ignore them and get arrested, and he's taken to the police. His group goes there and are yelling outside, and he's soon released, and they think it's because they scared them or whatever. That's what an LOL sounds like in email. Yeah, that was Emily's LOL. He was probably fined or given a misdemeanor or something. With Jones, he hates the government except Ron Paul, of course. If something isn't libertarian, it's the New World Order. Isn't it nice to always have an unseen bogeyman? There are people, thank you, Emily, there are people who can't live without that bogeyman. They just can't. And, of course, it's especially handy if you don't just have a bogeyman. You've got dozens of them. And you can just draw one out of the hat. New World Order, Bilderbergers, Trilateral Commission, Rockefellers, Rothschilds. Meanwhile, there's plenty of problems right in front of our faces that are desperately in need of a solution. But, you know, we can't do that because they've got that all sewed up. And see, but if you drill down deep enough into that stuff, and I kid you not because I have, you don't have to really go that far before you start seeing elements of the learned protocols, or the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. Because so much of this Alex Jonesian crap has as its basis and its root some of the most stinking anti-Semitism of the last 200 years. You got to remember that the protocols of the learned elders of Zion was a fraud and a forgery on the same the idiotic scale as, say, the Niger Yellowcake Uranium Letter or the Obama birth certificate. But the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion was a forgery crafted by the Tsar's secret police in Russia, and it has been perpetuated literally all over the world. And if you drill down far enough through Alex Jones, sooner or later you'll find it. Or manifestations of it. Yeah, look it up on the interweb tubes. Protocols, it's usually the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, but it's actually, the title is the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. And just compare what goes on in there with some of the paranoid ravings that you catch from a goofball like Alex Jones. Nah, he's not a goofball. He's a very smart man. Huckster. Snake oil salesman like Alex Jones. So, thank you. Thank you, Emily, for bringing that forward. And it's about a quarter before the hour, and I don't want to finish the program before we talk a little bit about this torture business. Step one, like I noted, it is being reported that, and the way CNN reports it, is prosecutor to probe CIA interrogations. Now, granted, that's still three stories down below preliminary finding propofol killed Jackson, but that's a different rant. Attorney General, this is the way CNN reports it. Attorney General Eric Holder has asked federal prosecutor John Durham to examine whether CIA interrogations of suspected terrorists were illegal, the Justice Department announced Monday. Okay, but that's, no. Attorney General Eric Holder said he decided to expand Lawyer Durham's mandate after examining reports from the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility, as well as a classified version of the 2004 CIA Inspector General's report into questionable interrogation techniques, among other documents. This is the quote from Holder. As a result of my analysis of all this material, I have concluded that the information known to me warrants opening a preliminary review into whether federal laws were violated in connection with the interrogation of specific detainees at overseas locations. And he said he recognizes that his decision will be controversial. But that, no, they're not investigating anybody. That right now, according, I mean, if you read the weasel lawyerly weasel words, what you're hearing is actually that they're going to investigate whether they should investigate. Which just beats the piss out of me. Because if, for instance, breaking news, as of today, 2004 CIA Inspector General report shows that interrogators who were interrogating Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, you know, that name that just won't go away. Remember, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was the guy who was waterboarded every 4 to 6 hours for a flipping month or something like that. Well, in between the waterboardings, we now know what was going on. Because the 2004 CIA Inspector General report shows that during these interrogations, well, let's use the language from the story. The document says one interrogator said a colleague had told Khalid Sheikh Mohammed that if any other attacks happened in the United States, quote, "We're going to kill your children." Meanwhile, with regard to a different terror suspect detainee, another interrogator told him that his mother would be raped in front of him. The interrogator who allegedly said that has, of course, denied it. There is, of course, a problem of proof. Is it just me? Am I the only person, and I'm sure I'm not, because you and I, we've spent so much time together. Are we the only ones who understand that threatening to murder a family member is not proof that you are operating on the side of good and decency and light, but rather proof that you are operating well inside the bounds of outright evil? You know, not little bit evil, but horns growing out of the head, evil. Pointy tail, cloven hooves, evil. Lake of everlasting fire, hell, damnation, fire and brimstone, evil. And again, you can make the argument that since this is 2004 when this happened, I leave it to David from Maine to concur or not concur, but this is another case of these rotten bastards watching movies. Anybody seen The Usual Suspects? Anybody remember the description of the scene with Kaiser Zosé and his family? This is that. They're so uncreative that they can't even come up with their own damned evil. They have to rely on bogarting off of somebody's Hollywood script to do it. But that's not all. No. Also, in the wake of that revelation, is more. Namely, that not only did they threaten to kill the children and rape the mother, guess what else they did? Why, yes. They then destroyed the tapes. Was it a year ago? Was it less? When on this program, when they were talking about, when the news was out that there were tapes of this or tapes of that, that I said, bull. No, actually, they said it had not been recorded, and I said, bull, it was, and they destroyed them. I seem to recall that quite well. Oh, yeah, here it is. According to Newsweek, again referring to the CIA Inspector General report, in addition to threatening to kill Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's children, in addition to threatening to rape the mother of another prisoner and to do it in front of him, the CIA interrogators also staged what are referred to as mock executions. What David referred to, involving a handgun, an electric drill, that was used on Al-Qaeda detainee Abdul Rahim al-Nashri. The Newsweek story saying Nashri's interrogators brandished the gun in an effort to convince him that he was going to be shot. Interrogators also turned on a power drill and held it near him. The purpose was to scare him into giving information up. Now, there is a federal law out there that says that you cannot use torture and that torture consists of threatening a detainee with imminent death. Yeah, we know what the Bush administration thought of that. The whole point of waterboarding is to, by their own admission, is to induce a sense of imminent death. But then again, Jay Bybee, that would be federal judge Jay Bybee, in August 2002 wrote a memo advising the CIA that imminent death was not, threats of imminent death were not illegal unless, quote, they deliberately produced prolonged mental harm. Well, that certainly leaves open the definition of prolonged, doesn't it? And they had a hissy over Bill Clinton saying it depends on what the definition of is. And they're splitting hairs over what is and isn't torture when every last godforsaken bit of it is. And it is with this background that Eric Holder says he's going to have an investigation into whether we ought to have an investigation. You know, I say draw the community chest card and go ahead two spaces and start the damned investigation. Never mind the investigation of the investigation. Let's get started. Because unless we want to perpetuate, unless we want the Obama administration to catch the torture disease that literally does come off of the Bush administration toilet seat onto his administration, just like Afghanistan, by virtue of not ending the damn thing, has become his debacle, just like Iraq is his debacle and not George's anymore, so, too, he will sooner or later have to take ownership of torture if it is not stopped. And having been stopped, if it is not investigated and thoroughly prosecuted and those guilty put in prisons for a long, 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 long time. It was during, by the way, according to Marcy Wheeler, it was during these interrogations with the brandishing of the gun and the power drill that Abdul Rahim al-Nashri cranked out a big old honking lie and said that Al-Qaeda was working on a nuclear bomb. Here's the punchline. The Bush administration destroyed the tapes of Nashri's interrogations in 2005, with the possible exception of the couple of tapes that are now in the possession of George Bush and Dick Cheney, and to which both men masturbate wildly. So, Attorney General Holder,
with all respect, don't investigate whether to investigate. I think we passed that. I think we passed that little signpost, that little Burma Shave sign, a few years back. And the fact that the people engaged in the torture didn't want to investigate is not any sort of compelling proof that you need to investigate whether or not they were right about it. Or investigate whether to investigate. Investigate, Attorney General Holder. Investigate. Investigate, indict, try, imprison. That's your job. We're told you're good at it. Let's see it happen. So that's tonight. That's the show, and where did it go? Mike Malloy on his way at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, about 4 minutes from now. And an ongoing welcome to all the Malloy listeners. I hope you enjoy what you hear, and I hope you find it worthwhile. Because of my ongoing and deep respect for Mike himself and the fact that he has recommended this program and this network. That it's profound to me. Thanks to everyone who financially contributes to support the Horn. Remember, the prints are still on sale. They are going out the door. They will not be here forever, and they are a bargain. The first few people to receive them have received them by now, and I am told that they are as exquisite as imagined. There's a button you can click. It's real, real easy. And it's a tangible way that you can go, you can step forward and be part of this ongoing experiment in a new way to do radio and media in general. Whether you contribute $5 or $5,000, which would be nice, and some people over the course of their support have, it is all put to good use, and it all makes certain that there will, from one month to the next, be a Horn to tune into. We're going to get to the end of August. September is up in the air. And September is almost here. If you can, feel free to hit the PayPal button or use the snail mail address. Either way works fine. Thank you for your ideas, your emails, your phone calls, your participation in the chat room. Have you not been to the chat room? Go to the chat room. It's a heck of a lot of fun. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Peter Godbold, continuing in his recovery. He is never far from our thoughts. Thanks to Ben Birch. Everything that happens on the Horn happens because of what Ben Birch does with WhiteRoseSociety.org. Never forget that. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. It is no exaggeration when I say that they are the hardest working, bravest people I know. They face things in standing up to a multi-billion dollar industry that many of us would question whether we would have the nerve to do. And they help keep this all going. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
then. About a minute and a half past the hour. I'm not back in the... Oh, come on, let's face it, I'm a doofus sometimes. I mean, I had it perfect, except for one knob. I didn't... As they might say over at the Guy James Show, I didn't throw the third switch. So I beg your indulgence and your forgiveness. I'm Bob. It's Monday. It's another week of conversation radio, assuming that I can get the equipment to behave as equipment, as well-tempered equipment should. And I think we will. And, I got some stuff on my mind. I'm sure you've got some stuff on your mind. But it's Monday. And by the way, I hope, thanks to everybody who tuned in for the kickoff concert for Still Moving Mountains, The Journey Home, the new benefit disc from Aurora Lights. We had a wonderful Sunday afternoon on the Capitol Plaza on the north side of the West Virginia State Capitol. Considering what happens inside that building, that was probably some of the best time that has been, the best use of space that's been used at that, done at that complex in quite some time. Magnificent musicians. Thanks to the Lone Tones. And thanks to Jen Osha. And thanks to, the Halftime String Band. And thanks to Andrew McKnight. You know, you've heard Andrew's song, Company Town, on this program a number of occasions. You know that for some reason or another, it just does something to me. And to hear him perform that live yesterday, I swear, I was talking to several people at the time when we heard those first couple of chords. And I kind of looked down, and everybody standing around me was the same as me. We all had goosebumps running down our arms. That song just does something to me. I came up with another one of my harebrained schemes while listening to it. It occurred to me that if you consider the truth of what Andrew McKnight's Company Town says about West Virginia and coal company and coal companies and coal country and Appalachia, there's a credible case to be made for replacing the state song of West Virginia, which is The Beautiful Hills of West Virginia, I think it's aptly titled. Oh, the hills, the beautiful hills, how I love the West Virginia hills, whether over land or sea I roam, still I think of happy home and those West Virginia hills. You can make a case that that should be sort of put aside and replaced with Andrew McKnight's Company Town. And it was a magnificent experience all afternoon long, and I was tickled to death to be able to bring it to a live global audience via the horn. And I will get the recording of it uploaded so that Ben Birch can make an archive of it and put it out there for your later enjoyment. Somebody remind me. I'll try to get that done after the show's over. I got to admit, I was a little tired when I got home yesterday. And there's nothing like quite like sweating the last 6 or 7 miles of the trip home when it's up a winding road, a mountain road, and you just don't know if you've got enough gasoline to make the whole trip. But we did, and as such, we got home. Ferg, Horn intern junior grade Ferg, did a wonderful job in his own right. You know, watching one's children grow up is always a bittersweet experience because they're so precious when they're little. And you know that you're going to have to face, you know, I mean, the alternative is no alternative. They have to grow up. But they pass these little milestones. And when I watched Ferg yesterday, in all seriousness, sit there behind the mixer and watching the stream as it went out via the computer, wirelessly, wireless internet, it works.
I got a brief and fleeting vision of my son becoming a man. Because he was all business. None of that usual running around and going crazy and that sort of the puppy dog hyperness. He knew that this was serious, and he was transfixed by the music, and he, as much or more than I, wanted to make sure that it went out. And he carried the equipment without, I mean, I did too, but he carried a bunch of it without complaint, and he took instruction, and we got everything set up and everything going, and I just sort of stepped outside myself and watched him and saw the makings of a man. And that it was something very much special. Of course, you all couldn't see that. We're radio people, you know. Video, not so much. But you got to hear the music, and what wonderful music it was, from beginning to end. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And like I said, I'll make sure that it does go up. I'll get it to Ben, and Ben, the hardest working man in liberal talk, will at some point find a couple of minutes or more that he'll never get back, but he'll make sure that I'm sure that he'll make sure that it goes up available as a podcast. I may have to cut the file in two, though. That's why I said it may take a little bit of work, because it was a solid 4 hours of broadcasting. And if you haven't heard it yet, I think you will enjoy it. The commentary by community residents in and amongst the music was stirring as well. So check it out, and I'll try to get some sort of post up or something when that's available. Yeah, it was truly wonderful. But no, I've got several different directions I could easily go at the beginning of this program this evening. This afternoon, depending upon where you are, sometime tomorrow morning in other parts of the planet, and I don't even know how they measure time out on planet Gorlop, but, you know, hello Gorlop, because somehow or another this is probably going out there, too. May not reach them for a few hundred light years, but won't they be amazed when it does?